And I would ask Tom to add any additional comments to that.
This section generally makes it clear that if a sector bumps up against its annual catch entitlement in a stock area, it has to stop fishing. It has to cease operations. The other thing that it makes clear is that the sector has to provide some details in the operations plan on how it's going to control the catch. It also has to establish a threshold so that it will notify nymphs when this threshold is reached that it's approaching the tack of a species, which helps to notify and alert nymphs that a sector appears to be approaching the catch. The committee considered setting a specific threshold, you know, just pick a number, say 90%, but upon reflection decided to leave that open because you may have sectors that have very different catch rates, very different operations, so you may not want to set the level at the same place for every sector. You may have a sector with a very fast catch rate where 90% is too late for them to notify the service that they're approaching the threshold, that, you know, it may turn out that it should be set at a lower value. And this allows for that flexibility between the sectors and the service.
Comments from the council? Questions? Dr. Pierce?
Just a comment. I like what I see. Especially the bold-faced text on page 25, where it talks about what's going to be in the operations plan and what the what details will have to be provided. I think that makes a lot of sense.
Anyone else? Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Unanimous, 17. Okay, Rip.
We are now on to interaction with common pool vessels. That's on page 25 and 26 of the document one. I will and let me put up the motion and then make a few comments. The motion, committee motion, is to include as an amendment 16 alternative the universal sector exemptions as described in the amendment 16 draft sector management measures document dated January 31, 2008. If you look on page 26, the second set of four bullets outlines the universal exemptions. In this case, it's an exemption for trip limits on stocks for which a sector receives an allocation, exemption on rolling closures, exemption on seasonal closed areas, and an exemption on ground fish days at sea restrictions. Tom, if you have any additional comments?
We had some discussion of this issue at the January council meeting, and this relates to what universal exemptions to be approved. There was a motion at the January council meeting to alter this list of universal exemptions, and I'm trying to remember if the motion failed or if it was tabled. It was tabled. The specific universal exemption that seemed to attract the most attention at the January meeting was the exemption from rolling closures.
Council? Dr. Pierce.
Well, actually, it wasn't tabled. It was postponed indefinitely, which, for all practical purposes, kills the motion. However, it is a very legitimate management measure for us to discuss regarding exemptions from sectors. And I guess I've got a question first, and that is it the council's view that we would have common pool vessels living by the rolling closures with sector vessels being exempt from the rolling closures? That's the way it would end up, correct? Common pool, you're shut down. Sectors, you're free to fish. Just I'd like some discussion regarding that particular issue since it has dramatic consequences for common pool vessels.
Anyone on the committee want to tackle that, or Tom or Rip?
Well, I think that the answer is it could end up that way. Obviously, we these are alternatives or measures that are going out for additional comment. And if it were voted through with all of them being this way, yes, you could have sector vessels in rolling closures and common pool vessels exempted from that. I think I wouldn't disagree with you that that brings up some perhaps enforcement issues.
Paul Howard.
If the rationale for allowing sector vessels in is because they have a hard tack, wouldn't there almost be the similar justification for non-sector vessels because they have an ACL that couldn't be exceeded if you go that route? Haven't decided yet if you're going to give different ACLs to different sectors, but you might be able to treat them both the same if you do give them an ACL.
Dave Gatham.
Yeah. Again, for the ease of trying to move this forward, I think the thing to do is to remove rolling closures from this list. I think we could spend all afternoon debating what rolling closures you can be in, what rolling closures you can't be, what's a spawning closure, we could be here the rest of the afternoon. I think we should just, for the sake of moving forward, remove rolling closures from the list of things that you can be exempt from. That way everybody plays by the same rules. And we can, at a future date, if we decide to deal with rolling closures, we can deal with it. But I'm not. I'll tell you everybody right up front. I'm not comfortable with anybody being in some of the rolling closures at certain times. And I'm not sure that we have the information in front of us today, or the time today, to sit here and debate which ones of those rolling closures should be removed from the list and which ones shouldn't. So, I guess I would make a motion to amend to remove the rolling closures from the list of things you can apply for an exemption from.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Discussion on the motion to amend. Jim Odlin.
Under current sector rules,
Jim. Tom Neese.
I think the motion actually is worded slightly incorrectly for the way the document is written so far. If I could see the motion.
You are so cold.
Could you restate what you said there, David?
I just want to remove rolling closures from the list of things you can be exempt from under this section.
Okay. What? There's really two issues here. The one is, first is whether you want to remove them from universal exemptions. And the second is whether you want to remove that possibility of someone requesting to be exempt from them. Those are really two separate issues. Right now, a sector can come in and ask to be exempt from a rolling or seasonal closure. If you want to take that off the table, then you may want to consider either rewording this motion or maybe a follow-on motion later. I think this motion should first say remove them from universal exemptions.
Okay, fine. I want to move them from the second set of bullets to the first set of bullets. I want them up there in the first set of bullets.
Okay, so, all right. When Karen gets the computer back, we can work on modifying the language so it does that.
Well, we get that straightened out, Jim. Sorry to cut you off.
Yeah, that kind of brought up my question. Under the current two sectors that are in place, I believe that they are exempt from rolling closures. Am I correct in that belief?
They're exempt from the seasonal closure, May seasonal closure on Georgia's Bank.
So, may I follow up? If we pass this motion, that exemption would disappear?
Tommy's.
Yeah, I think that's a question we need to make clear in the language of the motion. We have tended to talk about those closures in two ways. Rolling closures generally mean the closures in the Gulf of Maine. We generally refer to the Georges Bank closure as a seasonal closure. If the maker of the motion means both sets of closures, then we should probably use both terms in the motion. if he only means the rolling closures in the Gulf of Maine, it might be better to say the rolling closures in the Gulf of Maine, just so there's no doubt about which closures people cannot be exempted from.
Tom, you've raised a good point. I thought those were rolling closures as well, those ones on Georges. I didn't realize they had a different name. So I would say rolling and seasonal based on that.
We need to get the board up. Okay, we'll take a 5-minute break. Okay, if everybody could take their seats. Okay, we had a motion to amend on the table. We need a second. Dave Preble? Actually, there was a correction.
With the correction, I'm not 100% sure. What I seconded wasn't what came out.
Sorry about that. No, what I seconded was removing the rolling closures and seasonal closed areas from the bottom set of bullets. And the rest of it was added after I seconded it. So, no, I wouldn't second it the way it was it came out.
So then, if I'm correct, then we're back to the original motion to amend, not the clarifying language that Dave Gaethel tried to put into the motion. That's when the computer froze up.
Right. Right.
So this just removes it from the bottom bullets. In other words, it takes
just those. Just remove the bottom bullet. I would second that.
They won't be universal exemptions.
Correct.
Tom Neese?
Yeah, I'm not sure we're going to be able to recall this, but I think Dave's original motion was to remove rolling closures from the list of exemptions.
Correct.
I don't know how to interpret that, whether that means remove them from universal exemptions or remove them from the possibility to be exempt at all. You know, Dave Preble's interpreting that to mean remove them from the list of universal exemptions, but I don't know if that's what David meant. Now, it's complicated because we don't have the language that we first put on the screen.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna have to start over from the main motion, and then I'll go right to you, Dave, so you can restate. Because of the technical situation we had, would you just withdraw your motion to amend?
Yeah, I withdraw my motion to amend. We can just take that off the board.
Second, all right with that? Okay. Okay, Dave, you have the floor.
Okay. As it's stated right now, that's my motion. Remove the rolling and seasonal closures from the list of universal exemptions and add them to the list of measures from which sectors cannot request an exemption.
Is there a second? Seeing none, the motion to amend dies. Back on the main motion. Pat Kirkle.
We do have some concerns about including the rolling closures in that list that I think need to be addressed. The rolling closures were originally, as I remember it, sitting here at the table, designed to protect spawning cod. And there are also some habitat, habitat on the brain, harbor porpoise protection associated with those rolling closures. So if the council wants to leave this on the list, then I think it needs to look very carefully at what the benefits are of these rolling closures and what kind of compensation that they will need as a result of allowing the sector vessels into the rolling closures. In addition, as Rip has pointed out, there creates all sorts of enforcement concerns if you allow some boats in and some boats who can't fish in the area. So we have some concerns with allowing the rolling closures.
Terry Stockwell.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some of the same concerns, and so I'm going to make a motion to amend to remove rolling closures from the list of universal exemptions.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Discussion on the motion to amend? Dave Simpson.
Yeah, I think the other thing that would be a concern in terms of their value is an F reduction tool. If sectors become more than a trivial fraction of the total effort, then it undermines the whole value for the non-sector vessels, the conservation value for that. So I do think we need to do this.
Dave Pierce, then John Nelson.
The way this is worded now, there would be no way for a sector to request an exemption for the rolling closures. Am I correct?
No. What this does is it requires a sector to seek that exemption in its operations plan and justify it in its EA. John Nelson, then Sally McGee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's your clarification was what I was looking for. I was not clear whether the motion moved the rolling closures to that first group of bullets. And as I understand it, you're saying it does not. People still have to ask for an exemption from it. Okay. Thank you.
I see your hands in the audience. I will get to the audience. I just want to get through the council. Sally McGee, then Rodney.
Given the discussion that we had just a few minutes ago, I'm wondering if the maker intended or not to include the seasonal closures as well.
No.
Rodney.
Yeah, maybe it's me because I'm getting old. But I thought these were more to reduce effort on cod than the spawning closure, because we do have defined spawning closures. That's what I thought was to reduce the landings of cod. That's why they went up when the cod was in the heaviest concentrations, that we wouldn't allow fishing there because some of the boats were catching too much. I think that's our problem. If it's a duck, we call it a goose. If it's a goose, we call it a turkey. We should define what we really mean.
Pat?
I think you're right that in the document, the emphasis was on the mortality benefits of the spawning, of the rolling closures. But my recollection of the council's intent and the discussions we had is that those were specifically designed to roll up the coast to follow spawning fish, and so that they'd also provide a benefit to protecting spawning fish. And as I said, they also provide some harbor porpoise protection.
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah. These were all aggregation closures originally. That's what they were done for way back in the, you know, when we started with them. Then subsequently in Amendment 13, the judge added to them, and then somehow they got changed to be named spawning closures. And obviously there was some sleight of hand done where some are called seasonal closures and some are called spawning closures or rolling closures or whatever. But the terms have been used interchangeably, incorrectly, for years. And I don't quite understand. I mean, if you pass this motion, every sector is going to apply for an exemption from every rolling and seasonal closures. They'd be crazy not to. And so, in essence, all you've done is say you're lifting the rolling closures. I personally think that'll be an absolute total disaster. I think that large cod are concentrated in a number of these areas. There were fish concentrated on Georgia's Bank in May. That's why I made the motion specifically the way I did. With fuel at $3 a gallon, people are going to go out, and they're going to catch whatever they can catch the most for the least. And, you know, whether that's 5 miles from Chatham or 5 miles from Hampton, New Hampshire, it's going to be the same thing. Codfish are always worth money. They're going to go get their cod quarter whenever it's the quickest and the easiest and costs them the least amount of fuel to get it. And, again, having studied the system in New Zealand, they found they couldn't go to a straight output control system. They still needed input controls because if they didn't, then certain things happened that they didn't want to happen. And I think we're setting ourselves up right now for that very thing to happen. So, you know, obviously I didn't even get a second, so nobody wants to discuss the issue. But one way or another, you're going to have to deal with this. Well, all you're doing now is passing it to Pat and saying, Pat, you're going to have to reject everybody's application for a seasonal or roll enclosure. I don't think you've solved the problem one bit.
Dr. Pierce.
Well, I agree with David. Everyone's going to apply for an exemption to the roll enclosures. Why wouldn't they? Because the record is quite clear that, for the most part, if not almost entirely, the justification for these roll enclosures has been to reduce fishing mortality, period. That was a point made very emphatically by Tom Neese at our Groundfish Committee meeting on Monday. I remember that very distinctly because he came out of his chair. He was very, very loud in terms of his remarks. I understand that. However, David's quite correct that, you know, there are some roll enclosures that perhaps should remain as roll enclosures. No exemption should be provided for them because data we have in hand from a number of sources, including the state's cod IBS work, shows very clearly that April and May are big months for spawning fish up and down the coast. However, I would hope that after a request is made for exemption from the October and November roll enclosures, the service would conclude that they really aren't needed because they're not going to provide that protection for spawning fish. The spawning doesn't really occur then. That those two closures are primarily for reducing fishing mortality. So I would think with hard TAC management, the sector should be allowed to, you know, fish within those areas, provided they're constrained by their, you know, their TACs and, of course, the other measures that they have applied to their own sector membership. So I can't, you know, make a motion regarding what roll enclosures should be exempt, which ones should stay in place, because the plan development team hasn't looked at it recently, the committee hasn't looked at it, certainly, and this council is not prepared to look at it. And, yeah, as it stands right now, it would have to be a call from the regional office. And I don't know how the regional office would respond with the October and November closures, for example. I can't support exempting them universally. I think they should be removed from the list of universal exemptions, and then those specific requests should be made. And I'm hoping that, you know, that sectors would be able to find some freedom from the October and November ones, maybe others as well, but October and November just jump right out at me.
Frank Blum.
Yes. I believe the seasonal closure should be in there. I think the seasonal closure we're talking about is the Georges Bank one. The reason May was picked on Georges, because I was here at the time, was what month can we give up on Georges so there's a closure? And May was picked because the price of the fish was low, was after Lent, and May was picked. It didn't have anything to do with spawning or aggregation. It was just a month that could be picked. If there's anybody else in the council that was here at that time that can back me up on that, that's where that decision came from. And as far as the fall closures go in the Gulf of Maine, it was originally going to be a four-month closure. And I made the motion to make it 2 months, have 2 months open, and then two months the other way. And took a lot of heat over for the making that motion at the time, and it passed. So I think they can be looked at individually. And with that, I'm going to make a motion to amend to add the seasonal closures to this. And I hope this is... Why do I want to add it? Because I thought this was saying they wouldn't be universal, unless I'm wrong. Okay.
Then the seasonal closure is universal now.
I'll take it
this
back.
This removes rolling closures from the universal list.
Okay. Sorry. But that's the reason most of those closures, where they came from.
Anyone else on the council? Dana Rice.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I find myself in the unusual position of agreeing totally with Dr. Pierce. I overreacted when we brought this up at the last council meeting because I was confused myself over the rolling closures and the part of the rolling closures that are spawning closures. And these things have been in place for some time for whatever, and there is a mixture of them. And now we're talking about sort of opening them up, I think, in a restricted manner rather than throwing everything wide open. And I think some of them should be open, but if there's some spawning activity, I think we ought to protect that at least for a little while longer. We can always modify this in a framework or something, I think, down the road. So I support this motion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else in the council? Go to the audience. Joe Orlando, then John Williamson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joe Orlando, Gloucester Fisherman. If I remember correctly, those rolling closures were put in place mostly for spawning, I understand that, especially in the Ipswich Bay, Dave, but mostly was to reduce landings, and that's it. I remember that was like yesterday, because I used to come to every one of those meetings. And if we're going to be operating under RTAC, what's the problem? If anything, you should support it even more. Because in certain times, like October, November, we're losing millions of dollars of yield on other fish that we can target that we can't get to. Okay? And I know it hasn't been determined yet about the common pool part, if you're going to have an RTAC or not on that. But if it gets determined where you're going to have a RTAC on the common pool, they should be allowed in there too. I got no problem with that. Revisit the rolling closures, pick out exactly where the spawning areas are. I agree with that too. I mean, close where you think that fish spawns, especially in April and May. Okay, but I tell you right now, outside of that Ipswich Bay into the deeper water, we can target that haddock and pollock and get away from the cod. I've been waiting 5 or 6 years now to do that. This is a great opportunity, and now you're going to shut the door again? Thank you.
John Williamson.
Hey, John Williamson, Ocean Conservancy. It's ironic to be having this discussion now in this room, as I remember a very heated discussion around rolling closures in this very same room several years ago. I don't think Frank will forget that night either. And I think this motion is better than the main motion that this is seeking to amend, but I don't support this motion nor the main motion. I think you need to take a comprehensive look at rolling closures and the seasonal closure on Georges, and perhaps make a different mix for your overall plan. But the issues are several. I mean, having served on the Harbor Porpoise Take Reduction Team, I can tell you that the rolling closures are a key component of the plan that make the plan work. So you can't separate out the Harbor Porpoise closures from the rolling closures without a considerable amount of negotiation that has to be done not just here but in the Harbor Porpoise Take Reduction planning process. Additionally to that, there was a substantial attention paid to the spawning aspects of putting rolling closures in place. I agree that the discussion at the time was primarily focused on mortality controls, but there is a relationship between the spawning closures, the Western Gulf of Maine closed area as a year-round closure, and then the rolling closures that happen proximate to it and inside of it, in that the rolling closures, to a large extent, protect that broodstock population that is taken up residence to in the Western Gulf of Maine closure, and it protects them for the few months that they're exposed when they come out of the Western Gulf of Maine closure. So there's a really important dynamic that occurs between the rolling closures and the year-round closure that you want to protect. Additionally, there would be an enforcement nightmare if you had common pool vessels being kept out of the rolling closures, but you had other vessels allowed to be in there. How would enforcement work? It would be a nightmare. And then finally, if you allow those rolling closures to be lifted for some, but not for others, you may actually find that there's a that there has to be adjustments in the overall mortality TAC for some species like cod that you need to factor into your calculations. So if you're going to be changing the system of rolling closures, you need to do that comprehensively overall in the plan rather than do it as an exemption for sector plans. It has to apply to whatever the set of measures for rolling closures and harbor porpoise closures need to apply to everybody first. And then the sector plans can be independent of that. Thank you.
Carl.
Carl Bouchard, Fishing Vessel Stormy Weather. I think there's plenty of room for these rolling closures to be modified. However, I think the rules should be the same for everybody. Dr. Pierce mentioned October and November, Block 124 and 125. I happen to know that April in Block 132 and 133 probably catches less codfish than they catch in any month down in 124 and 125. So there's plenty of room to reexamine those, and I think the council should do that. They should also do that before making a decision. But think about the poor fishermen that are sitting here trying to decide whether or not to join a sector. I mean, we have got no idea what the rules are going to be on any of these sectors, and we have to put in writing and declare into a sector within the next month or two. We haven't got a clue what the rules are on any sector, where we can fish, where we can't fish. And the thought of if you join a sector, you can probably fish there, and if you don't join the sector, you probably can't. I mean, this is just ridiculous to the average fisherman here. I think you guys have got to make these decisions but just so that we know what we're doing. Thank you.
Maggie.
Somebody left their glasses up here. Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. In some ways, I guess that the, we don't support this amendment. We support the committee's motion. I would hope that there would be an opportunity for Tom to repeat what he said about the rolling closures at the committee meeting and their why they were implemented and how they were analyzed in terms of meeting the mortality objectives of the plan. To the issue of enforcement, there are exemptions to the seasonal closure on George's Bank now for hook boats, and nobody seemed to think that that was an enforcement issue, that some people can fish there and some people can't. I'm not suggesting that you don't allow them to fish there. I think that, you know, that's a reasonable thing to do if you're operating under a hard tack. I think if sectors have to apply for an exemption from rolling closures, it's clear that the regional administrator is never going to approve that. And that's why I think we need to put it on the list of universal exemptions. Thank you. And frankly, I think there are a lot of people who really need access to these rolling closure areas. If they can't have some hope of that, you can just take all this sector paperwork and throw it in the trash now, because I really don't see a whole lot of people joining sectors without some kind of realistic expectation that they can fish in those areas. Thank you.
Steve.
Steve Welch with the Mass Bay Ground Fishermen's Association. One of the biggest selling points for the sector and the South Shore was we were going to try and do something about these rolling closures. The reality of what's going on right now, even with the rolling closures, when it opens up in December, there's huge discards of codfish going on. I mean, it's just a lot of fish there. Given the opportunity, it's a small boat fleet, I think we would be better off, we'd be better served to be able to use our days accordingly. You know, I mean, 800 pounds of cod is 800 pounds of cod, and opening it up in October, November for a small boat fleet is a lot better than keeping them closed. What we have now is we're closed October, November, opened December, January, February, March, the bad winter months, and then it's closed April and May. I mean, if we could fine-tune it like Kyle was talking about, figure out exactly when, because, you know, the water temperatures, everything's changing from what I've seen in the last 28 years. If we could kind of fine-tune these spawning area closures, like the Massachusetts Bay closure off of Boston Harbor is a great closure, we need to modify our closure areas but open up more opportunity for the fishermen to fish when the codfish aren't going to be there so we can access other stocks like haddock in March and April. And as far as the harbor porpoise go, the harbor porpoise take reduction team meeting, I think we're going to be looking at mandatory pingers for all gillnet boats from October right through April, and hopefully that will solve the a lot of the harbor porpoise problems. Thank you.
Take one more. Vito.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Definitely what Maggie said, as far as killing sectors, this would be one way to do that. The rolling closures were Framework 27, 1997. So basically, just think about what this is. Pretty much the catch history period of, you know, 96 to 2006, you've got rolling closures being the dominant mortality control in the area for quite a few people. They were cherry-picked of the highest concentrations of landings of codfish in the Gulf of Maine, and those are the blocks that were shut down because the catch per unit of effort was the highest. Now, from a habitat standpoint, you would think the whole idea of an output-controlled system is to be the most efficient. We keep talking about selling sectors by efficiency, and here we are considering something the complete opposite, which is to continue to put inefficiencies on an output control system. There are market implications to that. There's been a serious problem. We've been losing market share constantly because of the interruption of flow of product. There are a lot of reasons. A lot of the benefits of sectors and output control management will be thrown away by this type of concept. The access to haddock in the Gulf of Maine has been thwarted by the April closure, and certainly the October-November closure are purely effort closures. I think there are better ways to handle spawning, dynamic spawning closures. These are things that sectors were going to be looking at. Reports of spawning fish, you know, these sectors will stop fishing for a while. There are better ways to handle that than these types of closures. The waste of in the openings, the biggest discard and the biggest problems are when you starve a fleet of hundreds of vessels for 2 months of income and everybody's out there at 12:01 a.m., not knowing what the catch rates are. We're not going forward in management if we don't do this, and they should be on the universal list of exemptions because to do it on a case-by-case basis, that type of subjective issue is going to still make it very difficult for people to sign on to a sector, not knowing the most important thing. Do I have access again to the stocks that I've been prevented to access for the last 10 years, or don't I? And, you know, that's got to be a message sent across the board. Thank you.
Okay, back to the council. Jim Odlin.
I'm opposed to this motion. I think this council and the service is just unwilling to allow us to go from an input-controlled fisheries to an output-controlled fisheries. It's almost to me like they want to have both. And I agree with some of the public speakers that we are starting to really waste some time here because I can't see many people entering into sectors if you continuously try to have both input and output controls. So I'll oppose this motion and a lot of the other motions that are going to come along that will continuously have both layers. We need to get away from that, and if we don't, this is going to fail. and then I don't know where we'll be, but stuck with input controls for probably another 10 years.
A couple more comments, council, anyone? Ready, Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. There's some compelling reasons to exempt rolling closures, and I agree with most of them. However, the universal of exemption is something, at least in the northern part of the Gulf of Maine, is something I'm not in favor of. After the Groundfish Committee meeting, when we voted to move forward with the universal exemption, I went back and worked with staff and was clearly, it's quite clear to me that there's significant spawning protection, at least in that part of the Gulf. And a universal exemption I don't think is a good idea. I think if a sector or comes forward with a proposal that's legitimate, as many of the comments were, that it's something we can do to move it forward.
Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Nine. Opposed? Eight. Motion carries 9-8. Dr. Pierce?
I'm especially sensitive to the concerns that were expressed by those in the audience regarding the problem sectors will now have getting membership, because they have thought, the industry has thought, that this would be a done deal, that rolling closures would be gone. That's the attractiveness of sectors. But at the same time, I've spent a lot of my own time, agency time, on the issue of spawning codfish, determining where they're spawning, when they're spawning, and researching what has happened in Canada and elsewhere to ensure that fishing pressure is not allowed to target spawning codfish, because they have very specific spawning behavior, rather unique spawning behavior that's been demonstrated in Canada and elsewhere. It's one reason why I've indicated before that the state has an actual cod conservation zone inside state waters, December, January, and February. With that said, I would move that for Amendment 16, rolling closures be reexamined and modified with the purpose of protecting spawning cod and allowing fishermen to regain access to areas currently closed.
There is a second. Seconded by Terry Stockwell.
And the reason why I make this motion is that I could, pardon me?
This was a motion to amend, right?
Oh,
no, actually, I'm sorry.
No,
I'm
a new motion. David. It's a new motion, yes. It's a new motion.
Sorry, you're going to have to... We're going to have to deal with the other motion before we take up this motion. So we're back on motion 10D, which was the main motion as amended. Anybody have a chance to read it? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Twelve in favor, opposed. Two, three opposed. Any abstentions? Two abstentions? One abstention. Motion carries. Okay, Dave, back to your motion.
Okay, the motion has been made and has been seconded, and the reason why I make it is that I firmly believe that common pool vessels and sector vessels should be treated the same way. That is, access to rolling closures should be granted to both, provided it can be justified. And the only way we can determine if it's justified, in my opinion, is to focus on this issue of spawning cod. I'm expecting that if indeed this does pass, when the analysis is done, recognizing that it's not the easiest analysis to make, that we'll find ourselves in a position where October and November can be opened up, and April and May would likely continue to be closed. We may get some additional insights as to other months of the year relative to spawning fish, but you know, I wait for that to happen.
Tom Neese.
Yeah, I just want to make sure I understand the motion. Is the maker of the motion suggesting that the only closures rolling or time-based closures in the inshore Gulf of Maine that should be put forward in Amendment 16 are those that are specifically designed to protect Gulf of Maine cod spawning.
That's my intent is with regard to spawning cod and no other groundfish species, largely because, as I said, of the spawning behavior of codfish, the uniqueness of cod, and the fact that you know this is the bellwether species for us.
Okay. Then, just so there are no surprises if we go forward with this analysis, I mean, you should recognize that there are mortality benefits from the rolling closures, both on cod and on other species. And removing those closures mean that something else will have to be adopted to potentially, assuming we ever get mortality objectives, in order to achieve the mortality objectives. I mean, these are. I just want to make clear that council members understand there are trade-offs here.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, the trade-off, I don't understand why there would be a trade-off because we have hard TAC management.
We don't necessarily have hard TAC management for common pool vessels. That hasn't been decided yet.
I stand to be corrected. I'm sort of looking to the future. Okay.
Frank Blount.
Okay, if I can go back in time again. The rolling closures were chosen in the inshore Gulf of Maine, and they were in the months of the highest codfish landing. That is correct. But what came off the table was cuts and days at sea. It was made very clear that there were not going to be any cuts and days at sea. So, but the only option that was left to the council was to have closures. And then the closures went from, I think they started off as a month, and then the talk was to be 6 weeks, and then they got longer, and they got longer, and they got longer. And then when we needed more, it wasn't enough, and people felt there was too much on the inshore Gulf of Maine. We started adding blocks in the offshore Gulf of Maine that didn't have a lot of codfish mortality, but it was like we got to share the pain out in the deep, or I should say the deep, but offshore. And that was also so there wouldn't be any cuts and days at sea. So everything was designed around that. So to back Tom up here, once you start opening these up, the common pool vessels, days at sea are going down dramatically. They're going to go down. I can't even calculate how low they're going to go. But I could be wrong unless we can come up with something else. But those closures were so we didn't have to cut days at sea because they came off the table right up front.
Dave and then Dave. Dave Gaethel, then Dave Preble.
Yeah, I want to go back to what Tom said a little bit because we get fixated on cod and probably rightfully so. But the fact is, and this is why I threw the seasonal closures in there as well, there is a lot of other fish that spawn in the spring. Yellowtails, May and June, dabs, April and May, gray sole, you know, on and on and on. You know, this is a cascading and cumulative effect. And you know, as Frank just reminded everybody, the more you take off the table at 1 minute and the more you're going to dump on it at the other end. So, you know, whether you're for this or against this, if you're going to be for it, you've got to tell us, you know, what you're going to do to balance the books. And you're going to have to balance the books on 19 species, not just one. So, you know, having lived in an area where there's a three-month rolling closure, I am impacted by this more than anybody. At least in Mass, it's 2 and 2. You know, I hear people say, I go 3 months without a check because of dogfish. Well, we go 3 months without a check because of rolling closures, and then 5 more months because of dogfish. I'm sorry, folks. We have to manage the total mortality, and there's no free ride here. You open something up at one end, you got to close something at the other end. Otherwise, you're not managing mortality. And I would predict that if we take the rolling closures off the table with all the other species added into this, that in a couple of 2-3 years here, we'll be back here making cuts and things because we'll be down to 2 years left in a 10-year rebuilding plan. We'll be cutting things the likes of which you've never seen. You know, we'll be talking about how you use your day at sea or how you catch your 10 pounds of cod or whatever it is, depending on what operations plan you're under. But I think people have been under some kind of a false sense that somehow they were going to get something for nothing out of this program. And that's not the case. So I just really want people to think about what they're doing here and what the implications are a couple years down the line.
Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to make sure I'm perfectly clear on this because I'm not right now. The way this is worded, this is not just sector boats. This includes all vessels.
Yeah, my read is that it asks for an analysis and a justification and then an identification of the rolling closures that protect cod and all other rolling closures would potentially go away. That's my read on the motion. John Nelson, then Jim Aubin.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The I think this does have problems, but just for clarification, we are not – the maker of the motion, I would assume, was asking for the rolling closures that are in effect right now to be evaluated. And if the analysis shows that instead of November being closed, you could open November, but you should close January and February, that's okay as far as the maker of the motion is concerned. So that you're not just looking at the dates that are closed right now. If you're looking to modify something, whatever comes out of that, if they're open right now, they could potentially be closed if the analysis shows that that's when they should be closed. And I'm just looking to have that affirmed that that's the intent of the motion.
Dave?
That is a possible outcome. Yes.
Jim Alden.
Mine was a similar question where the motion says to reexamine the rolling closures. And my question of the maker of the motion is, and a comment is, what does that mean? Does that mean we're going to reexamine the role in closure as to the effectiveness of mortality reduction? Because I might want to submit that if we find in the GARM that we've missed our mortality targets by a large margin, maybe these role in closures didn't do a damn thing. And we were just putting stuff on the table and never take it off without looking at some effects. So that's the question. Are you also reexamining the effectiveness of the rolling closure to the mortality reduction that we thought we would get and maybe we didn't?
No. Not with regard to mortality reduction. It's with regard to protection of spawning codfish. And as I said before, TAC management will deal with the issue of fishing mortality. However, Tom Neese did appropriately chime in and say the common pool vessels may not necessarily be managed with hard TACs. Remains to be seen.
Rodney?
Yeah, Frank Blunt is right. I remember this. And we basically did it because at the time we did it, codfish was driving the bus. And that's why we put those in there. And we didn't want to take any days from a mid-Atlantic boat that had days at sea, very few, when he wasn't impacting the codfish resource. So that's why we did it. So I'm kind of mixed on this now. But the only thing I would like to have cleared up, and maybe it's me, maybe because I'm fuzzy after 3 days of council meetings, is we keep referring to rolling closures and spawning closures. So let's make it one or the other, or either a rolling spawning closure, so I know where we are. Yeah. I'd like to clarify that if we could. Thank you.
Anyone else on the council? Go to the audience. Vito?
Yeah, I would just like to point out, I was reading Tom Neese's body language.
From the back,
yeah. I mean, examining, we think Dr. Pierce's concept on this is excellent. The thing is from an analytical standpoint, to try to understand what the impacts are on mortality on an input control, it's still an input controlled system. The common pool would be a derby. You know, anytime you end up with a hard tag, even if a hard tag ended up on the common pool, you'd want to put inefficiencies on it to slow it down so that you don't have as much of a derby. So I just think that would be a huge amount of analysis for him to understand, or for the PDT to try to determine in this amendment what the impacts are of reducing the rolling closures using trip limits and days at sea as the mortality control. But, you know, using hard tax, and I think another thing I hear people talking about, the difficulty of enforcement by having two different, you know, have the rolling closures open to sector vessels and not open to non-sector vessels. I'd just like to point out, you're going to have a dual system no matter what. When there aren't rolling closures, we're going to have vessels with no trip limits and vessels with trip limits. We're going to have vessels with no hook and net restrictions, or different hook and net restrictions, and vessels with hook and net restrictions. We're going to have all kinds of that overlap happening. I mean, the rolling closures would probably be the easiest one to understand, because if you've got a vessel and it's inside the rolling closure period, then he'd better either be a sector vessel or he's in violation. I don't think you'd have a simpler situation enforcement-wise. You don't have an overlap there. So, you know, I really think that these asking to have a modified strip across the board is going to be very difficult. I think to ask the PDT to look at the old rolling, all the rolling closures, and ask them to tell us which ones were implemented solely for the purpose of mortality reduction as a point of looking at CPUE, is to have the council have those, or the Groundfish Committee, look at those closures and put them in as universal exemptions. And stuff that's specifically there for spawning, then have that identified. That would be a lot simpler thing for the PDT than to understand the mortality implications of removing rolling closures on the common pool.
Carl?
Yeah, Carl Boucher, Fishing Vessel, Stormy Weather. 2 points. One to Rodney's question about these rolling closures, spawning closures, or whatever. Number one, they're just plain closures. They're not rolling closures. When this originally started, Block 124, 125 were closed in the month of March, and then it rolled up the coast to 132 and 133 that was closed in April. And then it rolled a little bit further up, and that one was closed in May. That wasn't enough. So then we did March and April, and we did April and May in the next one, and then so on up the case. Now we're closed. Mass Bay was closed for 6 months at a time. Amendment 13 modified that to 4 months. Gulf of Ipswich Bay is closed 3 months. That don't roll. There's no such thing as rolling closures anymore. Let's get that off the table. It's just plain closures. Simple as that. The second point I want to make is we keep separating sector vessels from common pool vessels. I want to tell you something. The common pool is a sector. That's what's left. That's no different than any other sector that's out there. And the way I understand it, it will be managed under a hard tack, even though I don't think that rule is final yet. So we're going to have 20 sectors, not 19. Let's not kid ourselves. Thank you.
Joe?
Yeah, Joe Lando again. As a fisherman, I'm having a hard time understanding this. If I'm going to fish onto a hard tack, okay, and I get my whatever quota I get so much cod, okay? The way I'm fishing right now, I just target cod and yellowtails, okay? So if I use my days old quota or whatever it is at a time, let's say October, November, and I can catch maybe my cod, but I can catch my haddock and pollock and gray sole and whatever and a few monk, what's the difference if I catch them in October or I catch them in September? Can anybody tell me what the difference is? I don't see any difference at all, except that maybe I'm bettering myself by catching more fish and making my business stronger. I just don't understand it. Thank you.
Okay, back to John Williamson.
Just a comment and a question. Comment first is that I think the difference between fishing under a hard tack and observing spawning closures is the difference between catching 500 pounds of 4-year-old fish and catching 500 pounds of 30-pound fish that are ripe and running all over the deck. The question I have is that all of these rolling closures, even the ones in November and December, and the seasonal closure on George's Bank all have a spawning component to them.
a component of protection for spawning fish, some more, some less. Some areas that are closed under these rolling closures have more relevance for spawning than others. If you're going to make a motion such as this, there's got to be an implicit standard of protection for spawning that has to be in there. Okay, or is it that you want to, what extent of spawning do you want to protect? And I'd suggest that you want to err on the side of protecting more rather than less.
Okay, back to the council. Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Four. Opposed? Eleven. Abstentions? The motion fails 4-11 with one abstention. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We are now moving down to monitoring and enforcement. This is on page 27 of document number one. Get the motion up there, a committee motion to include as an amendment 16 alternative, the monitoring and enforcement provisions as described in the Amendment 16 draft sector management measures document dated 31 January 2008. The monitoring and enforcement provisions are the two sections there that are grayed under the monitoring and enforcement landings and discards sections. Tom, do you have any comments to add?
Yeah, there's actually quite a lot in here that is either different or at least is more words than what is required in Amendment 13. Probably the best place to start is if you look on page 27, there's a paragraph labeled H4, Monitoring and Enforcement of Landings. Point out that there's a requirement that sectors are required to land all legal-sized fish from stocks managed by this FMP that are specifically allocated to the sector. But what this means is, if you recall earlier, there's three or four stocks that we don't give a specific sector allocation, so they're not required to land those legal-sized fish. They must demonstrate the ability to report landings to a specific statistical area. They have to report their landings and discards to NIMS on a weekly basis. There's a requirement to develop an independent third-party weighmaster system. A requirement that they identify the specific ports where they intend to land. Now, I would point out that some of these elements here are a little bit sketchy on this particular document. What's the Waymaster system look like, for example? The committee is working, as well as the NIMS staff is working, to find some examples of Waymaster systems. Remind you that GMRI has an ongoing project to examine reporting mechanisms for sectors so that, a lot of that information should help flesh out this section in more detail. Moving on into the next section, on the next page, at the top of the page, there's a discussion on discards. And this is that discards will be counted at the previous assumed discard rate, calculated as often as is practicable by gear. And that amount will be deducted off the top of the annual catch entitlement. This was a recommendation from the service that the committee adopted. This basically says that when you give a sector its annual catch entitlement, it'll already have an adjustment that's probably gear specific. It would have to be gear specific, no probably about it, that accounts for what we expect their discards to be. And then the sector may not be willing to accept that as the amount, in which case they can come forward and demonstrate to NIMS that they have an adequate monitoring system that gives them or certainty about what their actual discard rate would be. There's a section in italics, just to point out that this motion doesn't adopt a sector in italics, section in italics that follows about transparency. That was not adopted by the committee.
I I just have a question for the chair or staff. Page 28, that first bullet that Tom referenced, which talks about discards being counted at a previous assumed discard rate. When would we know what that assumed discard rate is?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, quite honestly. It's not clear to me. I think there are a number of other questions involved in there. One question is, when will you know it? Another question is, who calculates it? How often is it calculated? What's it based on? I think there's a number of questions embedded in that sentence that need to be fleshed out. The wording, I think, should actually, and this just came to me now, should probably be change the order a little bit. Rather than to say a previous assumed discard rate, which implies that there's some assumed discard rate floating out there, we should probably say an assumed previous discard rate. In other words, we assume what we knew was going on in the past is still going forward. We do know past discard rates, if from no other place, from the estimates in an assessment for many stocks, perhaps not all stocks. And just as an example, in the U.S. Canada area, the service periodically estimates discards because they have to do that to monitor the U.S.-Canada tax.
I guess I had one other question, which I don't think you can answer. It's more of an open question. If you have a multi-gear sector, then it may be difficult to assign a discard rate to that sector unless you know exactly how much of the fish is going to be allocated to each gear within the sector. I just throw that out as a question. Anyone else on the council? Mike Leary?
The committee talked about this at length, and most of the discards that happen now because of the mesh size are regulatory discards. If you have to retain all legal size fish, the discard rate is going to go right down to almost nothing in theory. So this is something that needs to be adjusted right away to try to get that to be as accurate as possible.
Thanks, Mike. Dave Gaethel?
Yeah, question. Sectors are required to land all legal size fish. Can sector boats within a sector transfer fish between the boats? I mean, it's one thing to say land all legal size fish. It's another thing to tell a guy who caught 50,000 pounds and his boat only holds 10 to take it home. So I'm wondering if we're going to be allowed to have boats within a sector. If some guy gets a big set, they can transfer what they can't carry home to other sector boats so that the fish don't get wasted, but you know, still comply with the law.
Tom, I don't believe we had that direct discussion or on that.
Well, no, we didn't. I mean, there were some other points that the committee raised that there were questions. We talked about John's issue about gear specific, if you have a sector with multiple gears, that to calculate the deduction, you need to know what's going to be allocated to each gear type at a minimum. We talked about, I think someone actually mentioned David's issue with somebody catches more than they can hold. Some of the fixed gear fishermen said, we get, I'm not targeting them, but they're the ones who brought it up, that, occasionally they have fish that are destroyed by seals or dogfish before they can bring them on board. They still have to land these legal sized carcasses, for example. There are a lot of questions related to that. The transferred sea provision is a provision in the regs that is not on the list of things you cannot request an exemption for. My answer would be if a sector thinks they need an exemption from the transferred sea restriction that they could ask for it. I don't know whether NIMS would approve it or not. It may create enforcement concerns. But I think you could request one if you thought that was necessary.
Anyone else on the council? Jim Odlin, then Dr. Pierce.
Yeah, I think this issue of, the pre-existing or previously assumed discard rate, it was the only way to move forward. There was no other way. I mean, there is a discard rate assumed right now in that, we have to start somewhere. The incentive, obviously, will be on each sector to, as fast as they can, to come to to disprove the assumed rate to be less, to prove the assumed rate to be less. And I see this as being almost the only way forward is to have this discard rate provision, and then it's up to the sectors to come forward with something else. And some may say they can't do it right away and it'll take a year. But other than that, I don't know how you would even start the sector mechanism moving. So.
Anyone else? Dr. Pierce.
I've stated before that monitoring is critical for the success of sector management. And I've also stated before that this particular strategy is at odds with the plan development team recommendation as to how we should treat the assumed discard rate, in that the plan development team has said previously that we shouldn't go with previous assumed discard rate, but we should use a rate that would encompass the highest expected discard rate for the sectors to encourage sectors to develop adequate monitoring programs. So those are my concerns, along with the fact that I don't know what those assumed discard rates are going to be, and is it possible that if those assumed discard rates are low enough because we've created a culture of fishermen who find discarding to be something that happens all the time, regulatory discarding specifically, will the assumed discard rate be the cost of doing business so that a monitoring system is not necessary? The only reason I would think that a sector or sectors would want to develop a monitoring program that is adequate is if the assumed discard rate is so high that they find it to be a curse and they must get it down to a lower number by having the monitoring program in place. In addition, the language on page 28 is a bit confusing because the word unless is bold-faced, and it suggests to me that we're not saying that a sector has to develop an adequate monitoring program. We're saying that an adequate monitoring program would only be necessary if a sector wants to remove the presumed discard rate. That's my interpretation of this text, so I need a clarification. Is my interpretation correct?
Yes.
All right, and that's not good. I would therefore move to amend the motion to modify the language on page 28. Language that begins discards will be counted. I should probably read the whole thing. The motion would be discards will be counted at the previous assumed discard rate, calculated as often as is practicable by GEAR, and the amounts will be deducted off the top of the ACEs, period. New sentence. A sector must develop an adequate monitoring system and demonstrate to NIPS that discards can be accurately monitored and counted as part of the ACE, comma, at the sector's expense. And the last sentence stands as is. Details about such a monitoring system should be provided in the sector's operation plan. And here's the added sentence. So this is really a slight modification, but yet an important one to the text that's before us now. But this is the new sentence. This system will enable the sector to deduct actual discards from the ACEs instead of assumed discard rates. That is my motion.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Simpson. Discussion on the motion to amend. Sally McGee.
Yeah, I support the motion. There's one word in there that I would wonder if the maker of the motion would consider changing. It's about halfway down, and it's the word should, as it applies to the requirements in the operations plan, and it would change to must.
Yes, that's fine.
Second or agree? Okay. Further discussion on the motion to amend? Pat Kirkle.
Just quickly, I'm not understanding the nuances of it. I guess if the maker of the motion could just explain how you see this in relation to what was there. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Sure. It's the word unless. There's no way, there's no specification, no direction, no mandate that a sector is going to have to develop an adequate monitoring system. It's only the unless. So if a sector decides that the assumed discard rate is livable, they'll live with it. I would. As opposed to having to go through the aggravation of having a monitoring system judged to be adequate, and that's the key word, because we still don't know what adequate is. Some would say an observer program that would have 80% of all the trips covered. Some would say that's insane. It should be 20%. I don't know what the number is, and that's subject for further debate as we move down the road towards determining how these hard TACs are going to be accounted for. There's no other restriction on the effort within a sector than the TAC. Days at sea fall away. Days at sea was a stop. You use your days at sea, you're all done. With the TAC, not necessarily. Unless the monitoring is really good and we know what's being caught, then the mandate comes from the service. Your sector is closed because you have taken your TAC. I've always said that the only way I'll support sector management is if I can be very confident that I know what's going on with regards to catch. And that's why I'm putting this emphasis on get rid of the word unless. And it has to be a mandatory, adequate monitoring system.
Anyone else on the council? Anyone in the audience? Eric Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to bring light to an issue that Mike Leary brought forward with respect to, pretty much irrespective of this motion right here, there would be some structured discard rate put into the development of the ACLs or ACEs. So I still kind of wonder why there isn't some emphasis that through the observer program, that discard rate is there now for somebody to develop the discard rate. And knowing that if there's a component of that discard rate that has been made up of legal fish that have been discarded because of trip limits, so on and so forth, and those would have to be retained now, that somebody should make an effort to redevelop that discard rate, knowing that the circumstances are going to change with sectors. It is somewhat respective to this motion, but it is an important point if you're going to be taking a step, your first steps into this discussion. And I think there is probably the ability to have an adjusted discard rate with the previous information that they would use to formulate the discard rate. Thank you.
Anyone else? Eric.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Eric Brazier, Cape Cod Commercial Hook Fishermen's Association. I'll make this brief. We support this motion. I'm very glad that Dr. Pierce picked up on this language. As we've said before and will continue to say, the monitoring of these sectors is going to be the determination of whether or not they succeed or fail. In my mind, my personal opinion is that no matter what other decisions we make here, if we don't have an adequate monitoring system, we're going to be in a lot of trouble. So we fully support this. As you know, we've developed our own monitoring program for the fixed gear sector. There's a lot of initiative being taken by the industry, between our group, the Coalition, the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and other groups that are really pushing to develop this from a bottom-up level. And we encourage the council and the service to work with us as much as possible. Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council. Paul Howard, then Jen Otwood.
I was going to say that the, around the world where we've had output systems, there's an absolute strong tie between monitoring and enforcement. And what we're doing here is placing now enforcement down on the local level. And I think what we have to do, or I would suggest, is perhaps that you task the enforcement committee to take a hard look at, monitoring enforcement systems around the world dealing with communities or sector allocations or whatever. And, we really have to have compliance with everybody. And if you have one rogue sector, it could really throw the whole thing out. We talk about just individuals violating, but going to a whole new system from input to output where we've had, haven't really had to cap our landings. We've been capping effort. We really need an awful lot of monitoring enforcement, and I think they go hand in glove, that we might want to look at strong enforcement penalties to make sure things work.
Jim Adler.
A question of the maker of the motion is, to what standard are we trying to go here? Accurately monitored, would that be the standard of our SBRM standard, or is that some other standard above and beyond that, and who will decide what that standard is going to be?
Well, I'm hoping that this council can provide the service with its own opinion as to what adequate is. It may be a moving target. It may relate to the SBRM. That I don't know for sure. So I really can't answer you, Jimmy's, but because the word adequate is in the original motion to begin with, and that's going to be subject for further work by the, by the Groundfish Committee, certainly working with a lot of important input from the service.
Anyone else on the council? Dave Gatham.
Yeah, Dave, just a question for you so I can understand this better. Under the first part of this, let's just assume the discard rate is 15% and you get 50,000 pounds of quota. You'll just deduct 15% and you'll be allowed to land 43,500 pounds of fish. Would that be correct?
I'm assuming that's what it means.
Yeah, assuming that, okay. But then on the second part of this, what you've written here, if you can no longer just take that assumed 15% discard rate and you only are allowed to catch 50,000 pounds of fish and it costs you $1,200 a day for an observer and that observer now costs you $60,000 to land 50,000 pounds of fish, is that what you're saying here, that that's acceptable, that whatever level of observer coverage will be borne by the sector, and they'll have to pay for this? They won't have this option of just taking the flat 15% and living with it. In other words, they may be incurring a huge expense to come up with the same number.
Well, regarding the monitoring system, as we all know, there's quite an effort afoot to come up with strategies to monitor, catch. GMRI is involved in this. I believe there are some meetings in New England coming up next week and maybe the week beyond. So all of the specifics, all of the elements of the monitoring system, I suspect we'll have to visit again at an upcoming committee and then council meeting. Because, indeed, what will it be? Will we eventually decide that we're going to have to require that there be a privatized at-sea catch monitoring program separate from the National Marine Fisheries Service Observer Program? Will we be using electronic means to determine what's coming aboard and what's being discarded? I'm still open-minded about that because I haven't gotten the answer. Again, I wait to see how all this plays out after we have these meetings and after further thought is given to this whole issue by the service and of course us as well.
Yeah, I mean I'm sympathetic with what you're trying to do, but I mean I've seen like the photographic stuff. I mean we've seen reviews of it, you know, and people are sitting there squinting at it. Is that a cot or a haddock they just threw over the side? But then we get down to flounders. Well, hell, is that a dab? Is that a gray sole? I mean, what, you know, I'm trying to think of practical versus pie in the sky. And right now, practically, the only way we can really determine what people threw over is to put an observer on there, and that's $1,200 a day. And anything else is kind of theoretical. And I think a lot of sectors might want to swap a flat percentage for the cost of having to have pay those observers to go out and verify that. I mean, it may just be cost ineffective for people with small amounts of quota to pay to have observers on the boat to satisfy this requirement. And you know, taking that flat, it may be just cheaper for them to take the flat rate, even if it's higher than what their real rate really is. You know, they may just decide they'd rather live with a rate that's unnecessarily high than a real one that costs them more to produce than the value of the difference. So I'm not real comfortable here where we're going.
Dave.
Yeah, to follow up on that, we must keep in mind that because of the amendments to the Magnuson Act, the ACLs, the AMs, it's extremely likely that we are going to end up with sectors having extremely low TACs. And it's likely, from what I've seen from analyses given to me by my own staff, that the Cape Cod Gulf of Maine yellowtail flounder fishery will be a bycatch-only fishery. And if that's the case, then discards, the issue of discards becomes even more significant for all of us. They need to be tracked, so the assumed discard rate may no longer be appropriate. Discarding may be much higher than the assumed. I'm obviously concerned about the expense to the fishermen, to the sector, but I'm more concerned about mortality of these groundfish stocks and what's thrown over the side. I need to know what's thrown over the side for whatever reason, discards or you know, I need to know what the discard rate is, because I'm awful tired of hearing what's going on right now with codfish in the Gulf of Maine, and the fishermen tell me consistently that in some areas at some times the discard rate is horrific, and I can't live with that. When something needs to be done to address it, and if the sectors can address the discard rate through their own operations, wonderful. The sectors are all going to be mini councils, and I say good luck to the sectors, because they'll be sitting around with their membership at tables like this trying to figure out how to make it work. And what a challenge we're giving them. But they want it, and that's to their credit.
Anyone else? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. 12. Opposed? 2 opposed. And how many abstentions? 1? 2 abstentions. The motion carries. It's now the main motion. Any further discussion? Ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. 16. Okay, we're going to take a 10-minute break. The last item we discussed was monitoring, and Cindy Smith.
Cindy Smith.
Cindy asked.
Good morning, afternoon. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. My name is Cindy Smith. I work at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and I'm here to inform you guys of a series of meetings that GMRI is hosting next week. I think most of you know that we've hired some fellows from the West Coast who are very experienced in designing monitoring systems for quota-based fisheries. Their names are Howard McKeldry and Bruce Turris. They're going to be here for 3 days next week. We're meeting with the agency and the industry and hopefully with you if you can make it. Right now the plan is to spend Tuesday in Gloucester, and we've set aside from, I think, 4 to 6 at the Rockport Bank building in Gloucester, second floor on Parker Street, to meet with any council members who can make it at that time. And we're going to meet with any council members who can make it to New Bedford at the Juan Sutter Club on the corner of Union and County Street. That's what Rodney just told me. Probably 4 to 6 in New Bedford on Wednesday the 20th. So that's Tuesday the 19th in Gloucester, Wednesday the 20th in New Bedford. I will be sending you all an email with some more information, but I just wanted to put it on your radar screen. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let's see if we can do an easy one. We're going to, in document number one, if you go back to the beginning to page number three, and we're going to work on, or it's section 2.2, research set aside. And I will offer the motion, the committee motion. It's a motion to include as an Amendment 16 alternative the research set aside program as described in Amendment 16 summary of measures under consideration. That is essentially the section 2.2, which is on 3 and all of page 4. Tom?
Yeah, just to be clear, you know, the committee passed a motion to have a research set aside where we set aside 1% of the TAC. We need to start fleshing out the details of this. That's pretty much all the committee motion said. So what we put in here to get people starting to think about the details is a lot of language that is based, I think, on these, I don't know if it's squid mackerel butterfish or just squid research set-aside program. You know, the committee hasn't debated all of those details yet in any, you know, this is the first time they've really been put in one spot. But we're trying to, we being the staff, are trying to push this discussion forward so we can flesh out exactly, okay, what do you mean by a research set-aside program other than taking aside this 1%?
Thanks, Tom. I just want to remind everybody this isn't a final decision, but we're putting this into the document. And as Tom said, the committee still needs to work on the details, but it's a good start. Pat Kirkle?
Well, we're looking at the language as well at this point to see whether or not this particular type of program would work in the multi-species context. A lot more complicated, frankly, when you approach it from that perspective. And frankly, I've just got to ask the question, don't we have enough on our plate right now without this? I mean, that's...
Jim Rule, then Rodney Avila.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having experienced this, I recognize Pat's concern with multi-species, but if you're just trying to flush this out and make a determination whether or not it's going to work, I suggest you do not lock it to 1%. The way we deal with it is we have set aside 3% and we can go up to that. In other words, if you make a determination on a yearly basis that you only want to allocate 0.5% or 1%, you can do that. If you lock it into now that you say 1, and it's a public hearing document and all of that, but you may be better served to try to have a little higher percentage and language that says you can go up to that. And then you could include language that says on certain species to minimize the concerns that Pat's got with the multi-species complex. But there's a lot of benefit in having this pool. It takes a little while to learn how to utilize it and to actually convert the fish to dollars, but it's got pretty good results in the mid. But it might be beneficial to think about that, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thanks, Jimmy. Rodney?
Yeah, I'm not against it, and Pat's concerned, but if we put this in, we don't have to deal with it now. We could deal with it later, or do we have to deal with it now? Or either do we take it out and deal with it later? Either way, I don't care. But, I mean, I think it's a good idea, and I like what Jimmy says. It gives you the flexibility of it. But by putting this in a document, it doesn't lock us to doing it right now, or the committee doing it right now, does it?
Pat.
I think without the kind of language that Jim talked about, it might. I mean, what it says is there will be a 1% set aside.
Jim Odlin.
Yeah, in listening to what Pat said, you know, I'm just trying to think of, well, if we didn't do this, if we took it out so that we can get this amendment done, research could still continue, but you'd have to use, A, your days, or B, your own quota to do the research if you were trying to do sector research. So that it's not like research would stop, it just would continue more or less the way it's been going. Would that be my understanding? With that understanding, I'd like to make a motion that we take this out, that we not a, well, I guess I can just vote against it. So,
John Nelson.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Well, also based on really what Pat and Jim were saying, perhaps it's just some refinement of words here. And so on page 3, second paragraph under 2.2, I would move that we amend the motion so that that sentence reads, for each regulated ground fish stock up to 3% of the available catch may be set aside for conducting research.
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Gaethel. Discussion on the motion to amend. You want to provide any other rationale or further rationale, John, or stick with what you said?
Hey, the wisdom to my left and the wisdom at the front table is enough for me, Mr. Chairman.
How flattering. Anything further on the motion to amend? Go to the audience. Anything in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further? Jim Odlin.
Just a question of Pat. This doesn't change the amount of work that has to be done, I don't believe.
Well, I prefer it, but I think Jim's right. It would still require us all to figure out how it all works between now and then, and so it doesn't really save the work during this critical time period where there's already so much going on.
Anything further on the council? Ready for the question on the motion to amend? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Twelve in favor, opposed. Four opposed. Any abstentions? The motion to amend carries 12-4. Back on the main motion as amended. Anything further? Frank Blount.
I just want to make sure the intent of this motion that those fish are also available for recreational research. I know it comes off the top, but some people know what I'm referring to here, and some fish last fall that were bought out of the research set aside. There was a dispute on whether or not they could be used recreationally. I just want to make sure here that that's the intent.
Tom Neese.
Yeah, this is a little bit different program than that. We're not talking about selling fish to provide funds. We're talking about setting aside fish that can be used by someone so that they don't have to use days at sea or something. And the committee has anticipated that that would be available if someone wants to do recreational research, recreational ground fish research, presumably.
Rip Cunningham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have been in support of this all along. I did vote for the
change to 3%, but I'm becoming more and more convinced that we're biting off a little too much, and I probably will not support the main motion.
Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor of the motion as amended, raise your hand. Eight. Opposed. Eight. Tie motion. The motion fails.
Okay. We will move on to section 2.5, allocation to the commercial and recreational groundfish fisheries. It's in document number one. It is page 5. And this section is the committee decision to make specific allocations of groundfish to the commercial and recreational groundfish fisheries. The committee motion to include as an amendment 16 alternative the allocation of groundfish to the commercial and recreational components of the fishery as described in amendment 16 summary of measures under consideration.
Any motion? Discussion on the motion. Tom Neese.
Yeah, I'll steal Frank's thunder and point out there's an error in this table. On Georges Bank Cod, it has some years listed, and I'd point out that that's my mistake. The committee had that motion on the floor, but they withdrew the motion on Georges Bank Cod.
So strike GB Cod from the table?
Yeah, and the issue is not, well, the issue is a couple. They weren't comfortable in particular choosing the years because we had some anomalies in the data that did not seem to make sense.
Dave.
Okay, I've had some concern with this allocation, feeling as though in a number of cases for some of these stocks it may be premature, and so I had a motion to amend just to clarify how this might work, and that is, and I'm not sure this is necessary, but here it is, include an alternative in Amendment 16 that calculates a recreation allocation for state waters on anticipated catch for the years ACLs are being specified. This alternative applies to this same table, less Georges Bank Cod. And the concern is that although this federal plan doesn't reach into state waters for state waters fishermen, so an angler from the beach, I just want to make sure that catch is anticipated and effectively taken off the top is what I'm trying to accommodate here, and that we don't ultimately tell a state that, for example, like Connecticut, that landed 4,000 fish in 2007, 325,000 anglers landed 4,000 fish, that they have to be cut by some percentage. Yeah, there used to be 1 million, now there's 4,000. They forgot how to catch flounder. That's my concern, so that's the reason for the amendment.
Is there a second? Seconded by Rodney Avila. Go ahead, Rodney.
You know, can we regulate that, a state? Can we, the council, regulate what he just said?
I was going to ask the same question.
Okay.
If your intent is to anticipate landings in state waters, I guess I'll turn to Tom. Is the only way to do that to actually allocate? Is that the right terminology, I guess, is the question. Or is there another way to calculate or anticipate state waters?
Landings? Well, I got to be honest. I'm not sure I understand the motion. We talked about it beforehand. I thought I did, but after listening, I'm not so sure I do understand it. I thought initially the idea was just that we would have a commercial and recreational allocation, and then within the recreational allocation, we would somehow subdivide it into a state water and federal water allocation. But I don't think now that that's what David is suggesting. It sounded to me like he was suggesting something different. So I hesitate to comment until I'm sure I understand the motion.
Dave?
Yeah. My intent is to and calculate anticipated landings for the years that we'll set specifications. Sounds like that might be 3 years ahead. Anticipate what those landings would be from state waters by recreational fishermen. Take that value off the top and then do your allocations. So, in other words, there would be a recreational federal waters allocation and a commercial allocation.
When you say take it off the top, which top are we talking about?
This will be a test of my knowledge of acronyms because I learned a few new ones this week. But presumably the ACL, you would calculate the ACL, annual catch limit. You would subtract anticipated state waters recreational harvest from that value and then do your allocation from there.
Which begs the question, what about commercial state landings? And maybe Tom can explain, when we went through the ACLAM discussion, I don't see any mention of states in here. So if we have to account in our ACL for the total caught, and it's in the assessment, what are we going to do with state fisheries, recreational and commercial?
Tom?
Well, there's a whole lot of questions that are coming out here, and let me try and answer some of them anyway. It's entirely possible that in that ACL framework, you may decide that one of those subcomponents is a state waters fishery, either commercial or recreational. So it could fit in that framework. I don't believe the council's got any way to extend its jurisdiction into state waters in most instances. We may have if someone has a federal permit, but certainly not other than that. So, you know, if you have a subcomponent that is allocated to state waters, whether it's commercial or recreational, then I'm not sure that you can would want to call that an ACL, because I'm not sure you've really got the ability to develop accountability measures and hold the state to it. So what that means is that if that component expands, then you wind up, in order to achieve your mortality objectives, you control the federal waters portion more severely. And I think that's right based on some of the correspondence between the MID and the service on fluke management, for example. But, you know, this motion raises some questions here. You know, the suggestion is that you figure out what's available to catch, you figure out what you think is going to be caught in state waters, and then federal waters gets everything that's left. I mean, that, if anything's left, that, you know, federal waters gets everything that's left. And as the motion says, that's only for the recreational. That's a very different. So that implies that that happens before you divide this share that we're talking about calculating here. So then, you know, now you've changed the formula to where what is going to the recreational component of the fishery, depending how you do the numbers here, is very different. And I'm not an expert on the MRF system by any means, and I know there are uncertainties about the total numbers. I'm not real clear whether those uncertainties enable us to really track within those total numbers whether, you know, with any better accuracy, what's caught in state and what's caught in federal waters.
Dave, was there a reason that you stated your intent was to remove an assumed catch rate of state waters recreational fishing off the top? Is there a reason that you wanted to take it off the top and not out of, say, a recreational commercial split and then remove the state waters component, recreational component, from the recreational side of the split?
Yeah, because I think our situation, even if you go back to, if you use the Southern New England winter flounder, even if you go back to 82, I mean, that helps things certainly, and the PDT and Oversight Committee recognize the issues that we have. I'm just very concerned about allocating a resource at a time when, in my view, Southern New England winter flounder are at an all-time low and in very difficult straits. And it's always recreational fisheries that disproportionately suffer when stocks are down because it's an inefficient gear. And if we were to
if we were to divide recreational and commercial, as you suggest, and then do a subpart of recreational, well, you've already limited the state waters recreational fishery, and that's, in my view, the council's reaching a little too far into, they're reaching into state waters now and to manage a fishery. Again, if you look at winter flounder in southern New England, the recreational fishery is limited to 60 days a year and a 12-inch minimum size. So it's not as though this is highly, you know, that this is unregulated. It is highly regulated. To Paul's question why I didn't include the commercial is because that could become really problematic, you know, for some of these commercial fisheries in state waters. We had issues a year or two ago with fishing in Massachusetts state waters. It really could have a significant impact on the overall picture. I don't know how we deal with this in New England. In the mid, we have joint plans, and the commission and the council figure things out. Here, we're just sort of, most recreational fisheries, I guess, are trivial enough that you just ignore them. And that's how it's been, I think. So I'm just sort of raising the issue that there is a recreational fishery in state waters, and you know, our public is completely unaware of this process, and that allocation would be discussed today or next week. So Paul has something to add, so I'll be quiet.
I got hands up all over the place. Paul Howard?
Now, this issue is huge throughout the nation. All the executive directors have been sending emails. What are you guys doing in your region with state fisheries? South Atlantic Council, Hawaii, they're having tremendous problems. So what I basically said is I followed an example to them of Fluke and Dogfish, where our federal fisheries are shut down if the states are not in concert with the federal plan, with the federal quotas. And so they were saying, really? And I said, yeah, that's the way we operate. So my question here is not about including states as sectors or anything like that. It's when we determine the ACLs, you know, are we going to take an expected catch-off of the state's rec and commercial? I think we have to. Otherwise, you know, we're not accounting for the whole mortality of that stock. So I just want, it should be clear that we're going to have to back out before we allocate.
John Nelson, then Jim Odlin, then David Pierce.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. The I think Dave's thoughtful approach reflects the problems that this mid and this southern New England have with a joint plan in which the feds and the states are working to manage a species. And they have various obligations to, you know, if they're dealing with quotas, try to divide that up and deal with it accordingly. In our area, the Gulf of Maine, anyways, and for many of the species that we have in New England, we haven't done it that way. It's not a joint plan. The states, I think, have always acted as stewards and looked at what the council has come forward with as far as management plans and regulations, and we have either put similar ones in place, or in the case of some states, and I'll think, how about New Hampshire? They actually have more restrictive measures in place than what the federal ones are. I can't say that it's just because I'm a super conservative guy, but, you know, we actually do have more conservative measures in place. I don't think that the council has and the feds have the ability to reach into the states unless it was done with a joint plan through ASMFC. And therefore you have agreement on that type of approach to tell the states how they're going to allow the harvest to take place in their state waters. Now, I could be wrong on that, but it's always been a somewhat of a sensitive issue over the years that I've been familiar with it. And we've always tried to, as I say, accommodate the recovery of stocks by, in many cases, mirroring or being more conservative. I can't support the council saying that, oh, here's the allocation that you're going to have for state waters. I think I could see the AG's office, you know, getting all excited to sue the feds again. So I don't think this is a good idea. It's not a joint plan, and I think if it was a joint plan through ASMFC, then you at least have a basis for doing something like this. But where it's not, I think you'd have to continue with the goodwill that has been generated over the years to recognize the states are willing to do their part to conserve the stocks.
I wonder, John, how you'd feel if we put together a formula that based the state's allocation on its square miles of oceanfront.
Is that? Yeah.
Okay. Jim Odlin, then David Pierce.
Question for Dave. You're moving to amend to include this as an option. So that my understanding is it would be the option that's on table one, and then there would be this as an option. Am I correct in that assumption?
Yeah, that's what I was doing. It wasn't in place of this, and as I said at the beginning, I'm not even sure it's necessary. I think what Paul said is it's understood that it will be taken off the top, but it's been my concern every time recreational commercial allocation was spoken of in this context that folks were anticipating managing state waters fisheries. So if Paul's in fact right, then we don't need this motion. It's going to happen naturally.
Tom Nace.
No, I disagree with the esteemed executive director. I don't think it is understood that we're taking the recreational catch off the top.
Right.
I mean, what we've said so far is we'll have a commercial and recreational allocation. We haven't said we would take a state waters allocation off the top.
What we're going to do.
Right.
That's the question.
That's my question.
Are you two in agreement again?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Payday's next week.
Dr. Pierce.
Yeah. Regarding how we handle state waters fisheries, that is, fisheries and state waters by fishermen who just have state permits, not federal permits, it's always been my understanding, based upon what's happened at committee meetings and what's been brought forward by the plan development team, that there will be a specific allocation for state waters. It's one of the subcomponents of the ACL division. Recreational fishing, that's another picture altogether. John has covered that issue fairly well. I've been working with winter flounder at the ASMFC level since the 1970s, and I cut my teeth within my agency with winter flounder research. So it's winter flounder, really, that the states are principally concerned with. That is, we have an ASMFC plan for winter flounder joint with the New England Council. I would ask the maker of the motion if it would be more appropriate for us to modify this so that instead of saying this alternative applies to species listed in Table 1, should it read this alternative applies to winter flounder listed in Table 1. Therefore, we deal with the winter flounder concerns and we let cod and haddock and pollock go the way it's proposed in the document right now. So that's my question, if I may, Mr. Chairman, to the maker of the motion.
To the maker.
Yeah, that's fine. My principal concern is winter flounder, because most of the recreational fishery, virtually all of it, my neck of the woods, happens in state waters.
Okay, I'd Rip Cunningham next, then Pat Kirkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was going to ask Tom this question, but yesterday we passed a motion which essentially had the committee continue to develop the PDT's recommendations on ACL subcomponents. And I'm wondering if this gets passed, whether we can mesh that into you know, what we were told to do yesterday, or whether the motion should indicate it would be part of that, or whether this motion from yesterday takes care of it anyway.
Well, we can slap anything together. It is going to have to fit within the ACL framework. I mean, I'm trying to figure out, in some respects, this is a little bit different than what we talked about yesterday, or might be a little bit different. Maybe I should word it that way. Um,
Like I said, I mean, my initial understanding with this is we have a commercial recreational groundfish split, and then we allocate something to the state. But, you know, it's been explained that, no, that understanding was wrong. What we're talking about here is somehow saying the state recreational fishery takes precedence over everything else, and we set aside what we think is going to be caught in the state recreational fishery, and then we divvy up the remainder is the way I understand, as an option, is the way I understand this motion. I mean, I don't have any idea whether some of this stuff can be calculated. I mean, I don't know how we calculate anticipated catch for 3 years in the future. I mean, I don't know. You know, that's a concept I haven't worked with, calculating anticipated recreational catch. Because if I were a recreational fisherman and I'm not, I'm going to tell you that I'm going to catch at least 50 fish on every trip over the next 3 years. You know, and I mean, this is going to need some further work, I think, by the committee, and this is the short version.
If I may, I think where I'm getting a little hung up is, regardless of whether or not we reach into state waters, which Mr. Nelson has said is a no-no, and I understand that, whether or not we reach into state waters or not, we need to account for the activities in the state waters. And I think, at least coming into today, my assumption was that we were going to, what was likely was we were going to split the ACL into a rec and a commercial component, and then we were going to further subdivide whether we create other additional ACLs or ACEs or whatever they're called. That's the first split. But I'm hearing that there's reasons why that may not work in certain instances in certain regions for certain species. And I guess it gets to, because we can't impose the plan that we're writing and ultimately submitting onto fishermen in state waters, we're going to have to, and unless we initiate a joint plan with the State Commission, Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, we're going to have to, in essence, work on a level of trust with the states to make sure that they're aware of the assumptions we're putting into our plan and doing what they can do in their state waters to keep their fisheries as close to possible within those limits that we're assuming are going to be achieved. So I think I've captured the process pretty well. But I think, as Tom says, there's still a lot of decisions that need to be made. Number one, do we agree that the split happens recreational commercial first, or are we going to go through each stock in each region and make a decision where the split happens? So that, to me, that's the question. Tom Neese?
Yeah, I mean, just as an example, let's suppose that we come up with a number and we say that the recreational, under our formula, the recreational share of winter flounder is 20%. And then we do a calculation that says the state waters fishery is expected to take 20% of the recreational fishery. Does that now mean the federal recreational all waters fishery is closed? And I think the answer is yes. You know.
Dave?
And that's why I'm suggesting what I'm suggesting. It's not as difficult to anticipate what the catches will be as might have been suggested. You have to do it anyway. If they're included in the assessment, if you put those landings data into the assessment, then they exist. If you don't, then they don't exist, and the state just gets left alone. If I were to have to predict 3 years into the future what landings would be, I'd look 3 years into the past. I mean, it ain't that hard. And if there's a little bit of stock growth, then you'd expect a little bit of landings growth. So it's not that big a problem. But I am saying, yes, off of the top, because you don't manage, because we don't manage state waters, recreational fisheries, and for the species I'm talking about, the landings are trivial, let them float for a few years until we've rebuilt the stock to, BMSY, and then we can talk about allocating more explicitly, and maybe there would be some, cooperative management with ASMFC. But right now it's too small to worry about, and I'm concerned that some, as I've said to people, some dragoman's 10-year-old daughter is sitting on the end of a dock and she can't take a fish and he can go out and take 30,000 pounds. It doesn't make sense to me.
Pat Kirkle.
Well, I don't know where to start. Mr. Chairman, I think you did a good job of characterizing what we need to do and a good approach to get there. The fact of the matter is that we have to account for the mortality. We may not regulate state waters fisheries, but we have to account for the mortality. So I know one of Dave's first questions is, I don't know if this is necessary, and frankly, I think it's just going to be confusing because we have to account for all mortality, every species from every sector. And so this just might be contradictory, or this just might create an unnecessary it may prevent us from looking holistically at this across all the species and applying a single approach to all the species and all the situations. So I would suggest that the motion's not necessary, but that people agree that the committee's needs to be spending time on this very difficult and complex issue, and that we have to have some sort of approach for consistently accounting for mortality.
Dave Gaethel and John Nelson.
Yeah, maybe I'm missing something here, but I fail to understand why this is different than dogfish. As an example, we're gonna split the fishery between commercial and rec. And it's going to be a percentage of the TAC. It's going to be recreational. And if the states choose to manage it, let's use dogfish as an example. They set different trip limits. But when the federal total is reached, the whole fishery shuts down. Why is this different? I mean, if the states choose to have levels of fishing in the recreational fishery that will cause the fishery to shut down, then I realize that the federal people can only shut the federal portion of the fishery, and the states can go on fishing and perhaps grossly exceed the ACLs and ACEs and everything else. And, you know, I'm sure we'll find some way to deal with that in pretty short order. But if somebody can explain to me what I'm missing here, why this is different than dogfish, I'd like to hear it.
John Nelson.
Well, I'm not going to rise to the bait of the dogfish one. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was merely going to say that, the states, many of the states, well, all of the states use the MRFs approach to come up with the recreational catch information in the states. And many of the states, if you would, buy additional surveys so that you have pretty good precision and accuracy associated with the numbers that are harvested in the state waters. We provide that report on an annual basis, actually to our federal counterparts, Fish and Wildlife. But we certainly have that available, and I suspect the other states also have it available in one form or another. And I see no reason why we can't provide that as to the service or to Tom if he's the one going to do the calculations to make sure that as accurate as a picture as possible of at least recreational mortality that occurs in state waters is included in the overall calculations. And I know I'm certainly happy to have whoever's coming after me to do that.
Terry?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. John just made some of the same comments I was about to make. But I understand the intent of the motion. I'm feeling very uncomfortable about it. I share the concerns about the development of a joint council-state plan here. We have enough time and enough of an issue dealing with the interstate issues with the ASMSC. Winter flounder is a joint management plan between the ASMSC and interstate. So if that's the interest, I think we might be able to remand it to that. But I believe Rip hit on it. I mean, the committee is going to meet to look at the development of ACLs, and I think if this is an issue, we should remand it to the committee to resolve the state and both commercial and the federal waters issues.
Frank Blum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think
where Dave was going with this is just when you set your ACL, you take into account the recreational landings, with the exception of just a couple of stocks, which I think the committee has listed here. And even on those, a couple of things to keep in mind. I think you can still get an open access hand gear permit and go out and catch 5,000 pounds of winter flounder a day. I think those are the regs. Right now, most of the states, well, I know Rhode Island has a four fish limit, and Rhode Island's landings have gone from 2.7 million winter flounder to 605 fish last year. Okay? And as far as shutting down the federal waters, it already is shut down because Rhode Island's law, and I think most of the states, are catch and possess. So all the fish that I catch on my offshore trips, which are Gulf of Maine or Georgia's Bank winter flounder, I can't land because the state has determined that it's catch and possess. So those fish I can already say goodbye to, so I have no access to the federal waters. Codfish is another example. For some reason, MRFs has stopped picking up most of the fish. Codfish went from 1.8 million in Rhode Island to 929 fish last year. And I can assure you my logbook data is probably more than 10 times that. So if we're going to start allocating based on the MRFs, we're running into a problem. Mid-Atlantic pollock went from 37,000 fish. And in New York, there's a five-year gap where there wasn't a single fish landed. Somehow I find that very hard to believe. Connecticut, you can go through, and if for some reason, these fish are falling out of MRFs. And they come up with an allocation. So with the exception of a couple of stocks, and I don't know what happened to Georgia's Bank cod. They have just disappeared off of MRFs, a fishery that used to land a million fish. I mean, granted, there aren't as many people fishing for them, but I can assure you the 929 fish for Rhode Island is wrong. I think you're just going to put them into the ACL takes into account off the top. We monitor them because you're never going to come up with a for pout, things like that. We're not going to have allocation of those for the sectors, but winter flounder is already managed to a point where the recreational can't catch any fish. AFMSC has done a wonderful job of shutting down that fishery to the majority of people. And I can get an open. Well, I do have open access permits. I can catch 5,000 pounds tomorrow if you could catch them. But the ability is there to get that permit to catch them. And I don't think we want to get into a situation which happened in the mid, which I personally feel something is drastically wrong there. When you have some of the splits on the stocks, and SCUP is an example of it. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, it's 78-22. It was set on years where they weren't available. And you get some big fisheries, so we have to be very, very careful setting those. So I think the committee's done a fairly decent job here. And the biggest question we have, Gulf of Maine cod, I think, is probably the only one that we're going to come out with enough data that we can come up with an allocation. Other than that, I think it's going to be very, very tough. Thank you.
Dr. Pierce.
Frank is right. The winter flounder fishery in state waters for recreational fishery has been pretty much shut down. We've been very restrictive. We've been following the lead of the New England Council relative to mortality rate targets. And unfortunately, we've been thwarted with regards to our dealing what we want to do with the recreational fishery because of mortality rates too high due to commercial catch inside federal waters. So we've been struggling to deal with winter flounder management as a consequence of that particular phenomenon. Now, this might not be a difficult issue for me personally to address and maybe other states to address as well if I was to be told right now what are the splits. We have a table that shows the years. I would like to know what the splits are for winter flounder, Gulf of Maine, and southern New England, Massachusetts. Is it 2080? Is it 1090? Is it 595? That would help me determine whether or not I really need to be concerned about Table 1 and the strategies that are being recommended right now. Do we have those splits handy?
Tom?
No, we don't, because what the committee wanted to use was the numbers that came out of GARM 3. We're not going to have those numbers until August.
That's right. It's GARM 3. All right. Well, that puts me in a bit of a dilemma because I would like to know what percent splits I'm agreeing to before I vote on this. I have no way of knowing. So I'll probably... Well, I'm not sure. I'm not going to support it. I don't know whether I'll abstain or object, but I can't buy into this yet until I know what the likely outcome would be relative to these splits.
Tom.
Well, you know, the committee had some numbers from GARM 2 through 2004, which, of course, doesn't include the years through 2006, and it's not the GARM 3 data. The approach the committee took was, let's agree on a process and have the numbers come out of the process rather than let's sit here and bargain over numbers. So that was the approach the committee took.
I think that's a fair point. We have a motion to amend on the board, so I'd like to take care of that one way or the other, and then we'll have the main motion, however that falls. But I think it's pretty clear that, as we discussed, was it yesterday or earlier this morning, I'm starting to combine the two events. We need more work on this issue and more discussion on this issue. However, that doesn't mean we need to put it off because it's a tough discussion to have. I mean, it's a critical piece of this plan. We need to figure out how we're going to determine these splits. But Tom's point is a fair point. The committee talked about a process in arriving at the numbers instead of starting out with the numbers. So, that being said, any more comments on the motion to amend? Jim Odlin.
Yeah, I'm still a little confused, and I'm hearing that we do this anyway to come up with the ACLs, and we have to account for it. And if that's the case, do we need this motion to make sure that that happens? My sense is we don't, but I wish somebody would just tell me that we don't need this, and it happens anyway, I guess is the question.
The motion to amend?
Yes.
Tom Neese.
Well, I think what happens is you have to take into account the catch from all segments, but I'm not convinced that what happens is exactly what David is describing in this motion. You know, we have to take into account recreational catch, but I think David's motion is going farther than just saying take into account recreational catch as a whole. He's saying, you know, specifically identifying state waters and taking that off the top before you do anything else. And I think that's a slightly different process that we're talking about here. That's my interpretation. I don't know if other people don't interpret it that way.
Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor of the motion to amend, raise your hand. One more time, please, because I've got hands coming and going. Holt, put your hands up, please. Seven. Opposed? Six. Motion to amend carries 7-6. We're on the main motion as amended. Any further discussion? There it is. Any further discussion on the main motion as amended? Ready for the question. All those in favor, raise your hand. Eleven. Against? Three. Abstentions? One abstention. The motion is... Sorry, Jim. Two abstentions. 11-3 with two abstentions. The motion carries. Rip.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We now move on to Section 3.0, Measures to Meet Mortality Objectives, page 7 in document number 1. The two sections that we're going to talk that are of concern is Section 3.1 and 3.2, Effort Controls and Recreational Measures. And as indicated on the sheet, the first two items in the section will need additional development as it becomes more clear what mortality changes are needed. Therefore, I will offer the committee I'm going to offer a motion that will need to be seconded. It's not a committee motion. It's essentially a placeholder to include as an Amendment 16 alternatives, effort control alternatives, and recreational management measures as described in Amendment 16 summary of measures under consideration. Tom? Do you have anything?
Is there a second? Seconded by Dave Preble. Discussion? Jim?
It's a question. You said to include as a placeholder an Amendment 16 alternative. What did you mean by that?
Well, essentially, it's what we've done in several measures earlier. We're just saying that, that you know, in this section, we will develop the measures to go out to public hearing.
So that means it's not necessarily this list, these lists, these, it says effort control alternatives as described, right? So the ones that are described, if you have them described, why is it a placeholder? It's just, does it mean they have no meaning or what?
No, Tom.
Normally, when we go out, when we go out to public hearing, we'll have specific measures in these two sections. The effort control alternatives will be based on these four items that are listed here. The committee also passed a motion on recreational fisheries to say that we'll try and manage them with seasonal closures, size limits, gear restrictions, and bag limits, though that's not actually printed in this document. But we don't have the details of what those measures are going to look like because we have to know what fishing mortality reductions we're trying to achieve. Now, the PDT has started working on that issue, even though we don't know what the mortality reductions are. We've been trying to first start working on the effort controls, but we'll work on the recreational measures as well as in a little while to try and capture alternatives that will give us a broad enough range that when we know the actual results in the end of August, we can fit them in. This is not an easy process. We thought we would be further along than we are now, but we've run into some roadblocks with trying to get an idea of what our current stock status is. What this motion means is that, okay, the committee and the PDT will continue to develop along these lines.
Jim.
Okay, so it's basically you're going to fill in the numbers or the proportions, but the choices of measures remains as it is here? With the exception that you had bag limits.
Right, pretty much.
Okay, thanks.
Anyone else on the council? Jim Odlin, then Dr. Pierce.
I guess I'd send this to the committee, groundfish committee chair question, that at the last meeting we discussed making some adjustments in existing trip limits, and I don't see that anywhere here. And I'm a little concerned that the description of trip limit triggers on stocks with trip limits, it's not that's not the same as making adjustments in trip limits. So what happened to the discussion of adjusting trip limits, and is that still a possibility under how you're reading this here?
Are you talking about at our most recent meeting? Well, I guess the best answer is this hasn't been updated from our most recent meeting since it was just on Monday. This document had been done and sent out. We haven't done an addendum to it.
Jim.
Yeah, just to make sure and be smooth, I'd like to offer an amendment that adjustments and trip limits be included in the list that we have. In addition to the 1, 2, 3, 4 items, there'd be an additional item which would be adjustments and trip limits.
Is there a second? Seconded by Terry Stockwell. This just adds one more bullet to the list on page 7 in document 1 that says adjustment of trip limits will be considered.
Exactly.
Okay. Any questions or comments on that? Sally McGee.
Was that a friendly amendment to the motion? Oh, we're on
well, I moved to amend. I made.
Anyone else? John Nelson.
Just clarification, Mr. Chairman. This is all of this document really is in a state of flux and development. Does the Groundfish Committee have the flexibility to address more than just what they have listed here? My sense was that, you know, if they're brainstorming and coming up with something, that they have the flexibility of adding other measures. Just setting the stage.
I'm just conferring with the committee chair to see how he's been operating, what assumptions he's been operating under, and he seems to feel that the council's already looked at these bullets at a previous meeting and identified them as the options, but he also makes the point that the committee looked at some very preliminary analysis that suggested certain scenarios that might want to be addressed with a trip limit. The bullets that are in the document are the bullets that the council had seen in the past, but since we've now seen some information, or at least the committee has seen some very preliminary information, they had a lengthy discussion about the use of trip limits to deal with a certain scenario that the analysis predicts may be possible. And I'm not trying to be vague. I don't have the information. We don't have that information in front of us, but...
Just to follow up, Mr. Chairman, I appreciate, you know, that sometimes we do have to be vague, but my sense is that where the council has given direction that these are areas that they want to have further fleshed out, then that's direction to continue to do that. I would think, though, if there's something else that the committee comes up with as we forgot this, we didn't bring this to the council's attention, that they have the flexibility to do that. I think at this stage they still have that flexibility. I didn't think we limited it there.
You know. Discussion on monitoring today is a perfect example. I mean, they gave us the concept and we amended some things, but still going back to the committee for further review and development. So, Jim Salisbury?
My question that is it correct that the council will have one more review at this bit before it goes out to before it's finished up enough to go out to public hearing? So that and if that's correct, we have one more whack at it, that anything in here could be added, subtracted, reconsidered before it actually goes out. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean,
and I don't mean to scare anybody, but I just...
The timeline we're operating under, and at some point today we're going to have to just refresh everybody's memory or reload their understanding of where we are and where we're going. The June meeting is scheduled to be the meeting that the council votes the document out to the public.
Then we'd have actually two meetings, or presuming that meeting is the last shot.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Odlin.
Yeah, there's a word we need to change, and that is it's adjustments to trip limits, not adjustments and trip limits.
Anything further from the council? Jim?
Question on that change. My understanding was that you wanted to the possibility to apply trip limits to something that it doesn't have a trip limit now. Is that what the discussion was, that what you already have up there trip limit triggers on stocks with trip limits, so aren't you really talking about the option to get trip limits on something that doesn't have trip limits? And if so, then you don't want to just say adjustments to trip limits. And to me, it makes a difference. I don't know which one the Groundfish Committee is proposing, but that's the way I understood it originally, is that they wanted to be able to put trip limits, possibility of put trip limits on something that doesn't have trip limits, right? Or bag limits. Yeah.
think that was, that's correct. I mean, they were adding to.
Tom Neese.
The specific stocks talked about at the Groundfish Committee were stocks that already have trip limits. It was meant to be adjustments to trip limits, and I would suggest that an adjustment to a trip limit includes adding a trip limit to a stock that doesn't have one. That's an adjustment.
Anything further? Paul Howard.
Just want to be clear to Jim about when you said, oh, we got two more shots at it in June. My hair went up a little bit. You know, we can't be adding. If you think we can be adding some things in June, no way. April is, when we look at the next stuff that's developed in April, that's pretty much it. And I don't think anything's going to come to the council but a finished product. So, you know, that's my gut feeling. There's no way we can do anything in June. It's just way too late.
Jim?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I said that there's one more meeting where we could, and I wouldn't want to say, I didn't mean to scare everybody, but I think you could, some of the issues that we've talked about today likely is not, you know, we've taken them off or put them on a list or modified them a little bit, and it seems though at some point you could get a final adjustment to that and say, well, let's, I don't want to preempt it, but just we could do something to modify that again, and then that's it. On June, you're going to have a proposal. You'll have preferred alternatives and that sort of thing, and it'll go. Yeah, okay, thank you.
Anyone else in the council? Go to the audience. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. You ready for the question? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Opposed? Abstentions? One abstention. Motion carries. Back on the main motion. Dr. Pierce.
Well, just to highlight a couple of things. Number one, this motion, if it passes, and I'm not saying it shouldn't, it gives a clear indication as to why sectors are desired by the industry, because this baby is going to be difficult to carry. The industry is going to find itself prior to sectors with some strategies that will just, of course, take the existing scenarios that we have and make it even worse. I refer everybody to Table 2 and Document Number 16. This is the document that describes ACLs and effort controls, and in particular, to all of the shaded areas. But before anybody gets too upset with the numbers and what it means, Tom Neese made it very clear at the Groundfish Committee meeting that these numbers are not real. But they do give you an idea as to the impacts of the different alternatives going across the top row. No action, 18% days at sea cut, 24-hour clock. My point is just focus on Table 2 for the future, because this will show you that the yellowtail flounder, that's where we seem to be, and winter flounder for that matter, that's where we seem to be in the most difficulty. I shouldn't say it. Again, I've been seduced by this table. Darn it. Darn it. Anyways, pay attention to this document, because those are the strategies that are being compared relative to which one gets you farther to where we need to go. So I just wanted to make that point. It's an important document, and it's going to be used by us in a refined manner, I'm sure, as time goes on and we get the GOM-3 results. Just to point out one other thing in this motion, and that is the recreational management measures as described in the Amendment 16 summary. I suspect that when it's all over and done with, the recreational measures for winter flounder will be adopted by the individual states, consistent with the ASMFC plan. And I suspect that we'll have a fluke-like situation. That is, this council will have to address winter flounder recreational fishery similar to the way fluke is handled by the Mid-Atlantic Council, where a region-wide measure is implemented for the EEZ, and then the states handle the measures within their own waters, all trying to achieve the same mortality rate targets. So that's the kind of discussion we're going to have down the road relative to winter flounder, I suspect, with the states setting the measures in our waters to be consistent with the federal plan, and this council having to adopt something that cuts across all EEZ waters from state of Maine down through Connecticut.
Anyone else? The main motion is amended. Dave Gatham.
Yeah, I'm going to vote against the main motion. I just want people to know why, that as long as it has discount days at sea at a minimum of 24 hours, I'm going to vote against it just to be consistent, because I've warned everybody from day one that this is totally unacceptable to a big portion of the day boat fleet, which will be permanently disenfranchised by it. So I just want to be consistent throughout the voting here from day one all the way to the very end if this makes it to the final list of measures. So just wanted people to understand why I was voting against it.
Anyone else? Ready for the question? All those in favor of the main motion as amended, raise your hand. Opposed? 2. Motion carries 14-2. Rip.
Thank you. It must be getting late in the day. I skipped over one. If you go again to document number 24, the list of motions that was handed out, I think yesterday, the last motion on page 1, and the corresponding section in document number 1 is section 2.6 on page number 6. And the motion I will make is to include an option in Amendment 16, which allows the owners of multiple groundfish permits to consolidate the days at sea / catch history on a single vessel and be exempt from the days at sea transfer program conservation tax. Said program may be limited to a specific period of time to reduce the administrative burden on the National Marine Fisheries Service.
Discussion on the motion? That is a committee motion. Anyone in the audience? Back to the council. You ready for the question? Sally McGee.
Sorry, I raised my hand partly just to slow down the discussion of this, and we've, you know, gone over the issue of the need and value of a conservation tax on the transfer program for several years, and I don't think that we should be considering just dispensing with it so quickly. And we also need to consider what the impact is of a transfer program in terms of mortality, and you know that's a discussion that we've had for many years as well, that there's the potential to reactivate days or to activate days that wouldn't otherwise be used. So that was the whole point of the conservation tax, because of the potential to increase effort that wouldn't otherwise be used. So for that reason, and because I think we have, you know, the primary purpose here is to make sure that we're in line with the conservation requirements that are going to come as a result of GARM 3, this is not something that we should be considering, understanding that the transfer program, absent a conservation tax, is likely to increase effort. So obviously I'm going to oppose this motion.
Anything further? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed? 3 opposed. The motion carries 12-3 with 1 abstention. Usually I look over here for abstentions. Rip?
We are back to section 3.3, which is additional modified sectors. That's on page 7 of the document. Getting caught up here. The motion for this is Tom. Tell me on this. I'm confused. Is this a committee motion or is this?
Uh,
You know, I don't – no, this is not a committee motion. Okay. The committee has never actually – you know, we've got 19 applications for either new sectors or modifications to the existing sectors. We've said that we would consider things, but the committee has never actually – and the council has never said, actually said, okay, these are the 19 that are going to go forward. All this does, section does, is this is a very brief list of who these people are and what they're asking, and Rip's motion just says, okay, we're going to move forward with these 19 here.
Okay, and the motion to read it into the record to include as an amendment 16, alternative, the sector applications modifications as described in Amendment 16, summary of measures under consideration.
Is there a second? Seconded by Rodney Avila. The point of this is to list out and finalize the applications that the council has received in the document or formally recognize them in the document? Is that?
Yes. They're going to have to be in the document.
Right.
And we've never actually listed them in one spot. If you go back to the June 2007 council meeting, there was a council motion which sort of generically said, in Amendment 16, we'll include these things, and it will include additional sectors or modifications to sectors. But we didn't identify the sectors who had already applied at that point. And all this does is, here's the list, you know, of who we were considering.
I will not entertain any motions to amend this list. We've already made that decision. Anything from the council? I see a hand up in the audience, so I will get there. Anything from the council? Pat Kirkle.
I continue to believe that the council doesn't have time to both include this and complete the midterm review, so I'm going to vote against the motion.
Anything further from the council? Go to the audience. Maggie Raymond.
Maggie Raymond, Associated Fisheries of Maine. I just want to make sure that what you're really kind of voting on here is the names of these sectors, not the details that are listed under them, because obviously they're not consistent with, many of them are not consistent with what we assume will be the policy, the new policies under Amendment 16. For example, the sustainable harvest sector submitted a proposal for 2008 that was consistent with Amendment 13 regulations. That's probably not going to be, it's going to have to be greatly modified as well. You know, some of the other proposals have no details at all. So we're just saying these are the 19, there are no others, and that's that, right?
Correct.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Back to the council, Jim Odlin.
Yes, I'm going to vote against this motion. Even though I've worked hard on sectors, for the last 2 years, I've believed we couldn't do this, and I continue to believe it won't happen. So, fortunately, I'll have to vote against this.
Anyone else on the council? Ready for the question? All those in favor, raise your hand. Opposed. Two in opposition. Motion carries.
Section 3.4, accountability measures. That's on page 11 of the document. This section includes one specific accountability measure for common pool vessels, a placeholder for other common pool accountability measures that will be developed in conjunction with the effort control changes, a placeholder for recreational fishery accountability measures, and a summary of sector provisions that may meet accountability measure requirements. All of these are going to need some additional staff and committee work. I'll offer one motion to include as an Amendment 16, alternatives, the accountability measures for common pool vessels, recreational vessels, and sectors, as described in the Amendment 16 summary of measures under consideration. I believe that needs a second.
Is there a second? Seconded by Terry Stockwell. Discussion? Dr. Pierce.
I'm trying to keep up, Mr. Chairman. All right, this motion references pages 11, 12, 13, 14, and 15, correct? With the common pool vessels accountability measure alternative 2 not being specified yet. That's to be determined. All right. Now, I need to make sure I understand the committee's reasoning. I wasn't on the committee when these decisions were made. In section 3411, that's page 11, it says, the council directed, this is the last sentence, the council directed the Groundfish Committee to incorporate measures in this alternative that would avoid Olympic fishing and hard shutdowns. What does that?
Tom.
Well, this was a subject of some discussion at the committee at, I think, the December committee meeting when we looked at this. And, some committee members felt there's nothing in here that avoids that. Other committee members point out that this is layered on top of the effort control system, which includes such things as trip limits, days at sea limits, rolling closures, seasonal closures, and that those will help eliminate the impacts of a derby fishery. But I don't believe there was unanimous opinion, and some committee members felt that the mitigation aspects ought to be further developed. If you go back and look at that actual committee meeting, there was actually a suggestion that passed originally at the committee that the committee develop and the council develop an ITQ system or an IFQ system in order to mitigate the derby impacts of a hard tax system.
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'm one of those individuals who believes that Table 2, for example, the breakdown of all the common pool TACs into trimesters will just create three separate opportunities for Olympic fishing and hard shutdowns. Again, I'm flashing back to 1977, 1978, 1979. I've been around that long. And it's coming. It's coming. But I guess there's no way to avoid it. I just wanted to point out that the word avoid is probably not appropriate. It's an attempt to try to avoid. I'm not going to make a motion to amend. I just wanted to point out that the future isn't black and white for the common pool vessels.
Jim Odlin.
I'm opposed to this motion. I was fishing in 1979 and early 80s. It was a disaster. This would be a disaster. Part of the place that put us here was people were trying to convince themselves or convince others that the reauthorization of the Act calls for hard TACs. I can't find it. We have no guidance that says that's the case. In fact, there's been a letter written from Dr. Hogarth before he left to Congressman Barney Frank that said there's nothing in the Act that says you have to have hard tax. You have to have accountability measures. And they don't even have to be paid back, according to Dr. Hogarth's letter. So I'm opposed to this. It will create an Olympic fisheries. It doesn't matter if you're trying to control people with days at sea. If they don't know if the fisheries is going to be open more than 2 months a quarter, they're going fishing altogether, fishing hard, discarding fish, getting nothing for them, because they just don't know whether they're going to have enough quota to use their days later on. So I'll continue to be opposed to these hard TACs. Thank you.
Anyone else in the council? Go to the audience. Dave Marciano.
Yeah, thank you. I'm also opposed to this motion. With that being said, if you're going to go forward with that trimester plan, it definitely needs further development and refinement, given the fact of rolling closures. So you're going to open it during 2 months, the first 2 months of the fishery was shut down? Come on now. And that being said, too, you could refine it, though. You need a trimester amongst gear types. That might make it work. You know, it's bad enough. It's going to be a derby no matter how you do it. But now you're going to enter gear conflicts, on top of the Derby, because that's how it's going to go. I mean, we're going to spend more time killing each other than we are killing fish. Thanks.
Anyone else in the audience? Back to the council. Anything further from the council? Dave Simpson and Dave Gaethel.
I'm looking on page 14 at table 3, and winter flounder, southern New England, today's favorite topic for me. And I'm wondering why area 611 isn't included in there as an area that would be where gear would be prohibited when the TAC was caught. Those are, I mean, it is predominantly state waters, but presumably federally permitted vessels. I'm concerned that they could be squeezed into that area if that's the only thing left open to federally permitted vessels.
Tom?
Well, perhaps the table needs a better caption. If you read the stock area closures, the idea here is that what we've done is we've identified the statistical areas where 90% of the catch is caught. And when 90% of the tack is caught, the statistical areas and gear listed in that table are closed to fishing by that gear. The concept being that we're trying to close the areas where the directed fishing goes on and leave some tack available for incidental fisheries that may take place outside those areas. But I agree that the caption is misleading, but it doesn't really follow the text.
All set, Dave. Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I agree with Jimmy Odlin. I was fishing back then, too. I'll never vote for anything with a hard tack for a lot of reasons, but let's just get one thing right up front. I don't believe hard tacks in themselves end overfishing. I think they may actually make it worse, and I think we're about to prove that. But I do have a question, Tom, on section 3.4.1.2. Says measure alternative 2 to be developed, so we don't know what it is. Is there anything in here that is that going to be other than hard tacks then? Is that the purpose of that section?
Yes.
Okay,
and
so
if I could elaborate a little bit better. I mean, the idea here is that as we further develop the upper controls, it may be, for example, that your accountability measures that you adopt will be tailored to the effort control package. If we rely on a day at sea reduction, you know, your accountability control may be a day at sea adjustment that's triggered by exceeding the annual catch limit or approaching the annual catch limit. It could be a differential day at sea adjustment in specific areas if, you know, you're focusing on differential days at sea. That's the concept. The idea here is to have something that contrasts with a hard tack accountability measure.
Okay, so by voting for this amendment, then, we are not only voting for hard tacks. We're voting for hard tacks is just one alternative. Is that correct?
I say yes. You know, I'm assuming that the committee reaches a conclusion on a different accountability measure, you know, that at least voting for it encourages them to develop one is the way I interpret it.
Okay, thank you.
Jim Salisbury?
What's the presumed value of voting for an alternative? What are we gaining by saying, let's vote now on this alternative that's unfinished, and we don't even have the alternatives to the alternative? And I can see a lot of difference. You know, it makes to me a difference, because if I can imagine saying, well, we're gonna support this as one alternative, and then, you know, with time constraints and other constraints, maybe the one alternative, number two, might be worse than useless or you know, hardly any more palatable than the first one, and so then you're really stuck. But on the other hand, I could see if we don't say, hey, we haven't supported this yet, but come up with a few more. You know, you put a lot more effort into getting a viable alternative when you don't have anything. So I'm a little concerned. I don't want to st- start doing this sort of like a ladder, and then by the time you get to the top, you know, the rungs are pretty shaky. I'd like to see at least something fleshed out that gives me what the direction of the alternatives are going to be before I start saying, yeah, this is a good range of alternatives. Because right now we don't have any range. We just have a one that's been hammered and hammered and hammered by some folks and hammered against by others, but there's no real sense of what the range of alternatives is. So until I have that, I don't want to vote on this first one. And I'd move to table this until we have some suggestion of what an alternative is.
Is there a second? Seconded by Jim Odlin.
I guess you can
all
speak
those
to
in favor of tabling the motion, raise your hand. Put your hands up, please. Six. Opposed. Nine. The motion to table fails 6-9. Further discussion? Sally McGee.
Yeah, I think this is obviously, I think it's important to keep this on the table, and if we can come up with other actual measures to keep the common pool accountable, as is going to be required under Magnuson by 2011 for many stocks, then now is the time to be starting to develop it. I mean, we decided that in Amendment 16 we want to develop that process for how the accountability measures are going to be implemented, and 2011 isn't that far away. And you know, if we table this, then we're putting off the inevitable, and all we're going to have on the table is hard tax with, you know, divvied up by trimester. And you know, I don't think anybody thinks that that's the best solution. So we got to keep this going now. Otherwise, 2011 is going to creep up, and lo and behold, it's going to be just hard tax, and that's, you know, not necessarily going to be the best solution.
Anything further? Mike Leary?
I have a question, actually. If, you know, we put this in there, then we go forward and sectors don't develop, does that mean everybody's in the common pool and we're going to manage under hard tax? Because we voted earlier that the hard tax was considered and rejected. I don't want to have the false expectation that we're going to have sectors and all of a sudden we're not and we're going to have this hard tax management.
I think that's where Mr. Odlin was before. Rip Cunningham.
Thank you. The motion that was passed, I can't remember what council meeting, I think it may have been back in June, was that we would not manage the common pool by hard tax alone, standalone hard tax. And the way this is written, it says these are backup hard tax.
Jim Salisbury.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I think Mike has kind of hit the nail on the head, and I appreciate Sally's comments that we had better get on with figuring out the alternatives because nobody likes hard tax. But the reason for my wanting to table that is because we're spending all our effort looking at how to mitigate the issue of the impact of hard tax, and everybody's so afraid of it that we're spending all our time trying to figure out how to do something to minimize the impact of it that they know is going to be worse than anything else they can imagine. So I think that, to me, until we have I think we need to spend a lot of effort on all. I can think of a lot of ways to approach it. I'm not saying that they're right, but there are a lot of different ways to deal with it. But we haven't even got there. And that we have one meeting to look at it. Maybe there could be two or three. Look at it. Pick one or two out of that. I think that's ridiculous. And I understand, you know, Paul's comments are, well, we don't have time to do this. We don't have time to do it. We not only don't have time, we don't have anything to look at, period. So now where are we? I mean, this gets to be down to the point of ridiculous. So,
Dave Gaethel.
Yeah, I mean, I think, I could give you three alternatives right now, but without knowing what the ACLs and AM measures are going to be, I don't know whether they're going to fly. For example, you could have soft tax with a payback provision for the following year. Or you could have decreasing trip limits depending on the percentage of quota landed, or whatever you want to call it. Increased differential counting is, if again, as the amount of fish landed goes up, the, you know, you count days more and more towards the end of the year. And so that you never exceed your mortality rates. I mean, there's a lot of things we could do, but we don't know, because Washington can't get off the stick, whether or not any of those will be acceptable. And so I am a little bit frustrated here. I mean, I'll flesh this out with, you know, and put motions on the board, and we sit here all night if you want to get this done. But even if we do it, we don't know if any of them are going to be usable whenever these accountability measure guidelines come out. So, you know, there is a certain amount of frustration here, and I suspect that's why the Groundfish Committee and Tom have left this as to be determined, because they can't determine it absent the information they need to write it. So I would look to you, Mr. Chair, for some guidance. Do you want to sit down and flesh this out tonight with an assortment of alternatives that would be alternatives to hard tax, recognizing that none of them may fly, or they all may fly, or do you want to wait till those guidelines come out and hold this section back and do it then?
Well, I think at best we're going to see the guidelines in May, Dave, and we have a meeting in June to vote to push this pile out the door to the public. So, you know, I'm willing to spend time tonight with the council working on another alternative or giving more direction to the committee than to be determined. You know, in other words, you could start by looking at the alternative that we have here and identifying what you don't like about it and trying to replace what you don't like with something that you do like or can live with. I mean, we can do that tonight if you want, if you think we need to do that before we send it back to the committee. I'm sensing around the table that not only are people concerned about the lack of a opportunity to actually get sectors up and running in 2009, but, my God, what about the common pool, which is going to be most, if not all of us? I mean, I think that's the shift that's just occurred here today at the table. Because we worked through these documents and started talking about what we do have and what we have left to do. I think the balance is starting to dawn on people that there's a hell of a long road to go between now and June to have something that we can put out to the public. I may be wrong. I may be stating things improperly, but that's my sense from the chair. So, again, I'll sit here tonight with you and help you hammer out an alternative to the hard tack trimester alternative, if that's what you guys want to do. Dave Preble.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think that would be a very inefficient way of doing things. At this point, I think that Section 3 should be remanded to the committee. I think to try to do all of that with the full council without anything in front of us starting from scratch is definitely the wrong way to go about it. I think the committee should devote a day anyway to at least one full meeting to getting this hammered out and bring it back to the council for the April meeting.
Jim Salisbury.
Well, I would agree with Dave, but, you know, we're talking about Section 3.4.1 in total, but from what you've just said, Mr. Chairman, if I could interpret that, we're going to come back in April, and 3.4.1, the second alternative, 3.4.1.2, is going to be just as blank as it is now. Or if we add two or three alternatives there, they're all going to be just as blank as they are now because we don't have the accountability measures. That's what the implication is here. And it's, you know, where does that go? I can't see how you're going to have any hope of remanding a blank back to the committee that said it's going to be blank because we don't have what the, you know, guidance on the accountability measures. So until we get that, it's going to be blank, and yet we're not going to get those till May. So I don't think the action that Dave has suggested is remanded back to the committee is destined to help much, unless somebody can explain it to me why it would.
Dave. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I think there's a great deal we can do. I think that Drew was on the money. I think it was yesterday or the day before when he said that the guidance that we have right now is Magnuson, and that's what we use. In the absence of clear guidance from the agency, we still are bounded by making a good faith effort to do these things under the law that we have in front of us right now. Also, just as a matter to make certain that Jim understands what I meant. When I said 3.4, I meant 3.4 plus all of the sub-paragraphs as well as part of that.
Pat Kirkle.
Well, that's exactly right. You're not going to have the guidance before you need to make these decisions. You just need to make the decisions with the guidance you have, which is the language in the Act. Tom went through yesterday and talked about ACLs and all the other things that are associated with ACLs. You have a lot of guidance in front of you. You just need to use it and move forward. And it's up to the council to develop accountability measures that they think meet the standards of the Act and then make that argument in the document.
Council. Mike Leary.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is the same discussion that we had at committee. We went through. We probably spent 3 hours. We came to the same result. And what happens in the common pool is you have an excess of days and not enough quota. So what people have invested in are days at sea, and they won't be able to use those because there's not enough quota. When that realization came to about, the committee took a vote, and actually IFQs passed, but it was ruled out of order. So we've had the same discussion over, and there was no resolution.
Are you suggesting that the committee and the council continue to rehash the same discussions over and over?
No. What I suggested at committee was to have my kids do this because we don't know what the end result is. We might as well have them do it.
Okay. Jim Odlin.
This adjustment has to be done in 09. By any stretch of the imagination, the law, accountability measures don't have to be in place till 010 or 011, depending on the species. I think we need to find a way to, in this amendment, to come up with some broad alternative accountability measures that are frameworkable to be implemented when they need to be implemented, which is 010 or 011. And that would take the threat of some of this pressure off from us and allow us to move this thing forward. And it just may be a way out. I don't know. We're trying to do something a year or 2 years ahead of when it's required without knowing what it is we need to be doing. So that's where I'm at. I think we ought to be able to figure out a way to not have to take the action on this stuff other than except make it a frameworkable, a few ideas that are frameworkable that we can work on after this gets out the door and we make our adjustments and that are needed by law for Amendment 16.
Thanks, Jim. Tom, or the committee chair, correct me if I'm wrong, but when we last talked as a full council about ACLs and AMs and this amendment, we talked about the process of setting ACLs. Is that right? In other words, we were going to write into the amendment the process that we were going to use to set the ACLs. And then...
Yeah, we did. But if you recall, I asked the question, what does that mean? What do we have to put in? And the answer I got was, well, everything. You know, so it's not clear to me. I've never had a clear understanding of how, if we focus on process, how that makes things any easier and, you know, because of the response that it means we put in everything.
Fair enough. Jim Salisbury.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like one brief opportunity to explain my frustration. And it's not, I think it's been clear to us all along that of the situation with the accountability measures. And I don't fault the committee or the staff for being bewildered and not having much to offer at this point. Pat's been very clear all along that, you know, she thinks that we don't have time to do this and the sectors all together at the same time. I understand that perspective. I've thought all along that we could, if we really buckled down to do sectors, which is the only way that you're going to that I can see to have a viable alternative to the hard tack option for that doesn't become really a hard tack for everybody, because there is no sectors unless you get a procedure through. So I thought that we could get some form of sector relief that would help minimize this problem. The problem that I've seen today is that we have pretty much, or we are in the process of destroying the potential. Even if we can pass a motion for sectors, we've almost destroyed the concept of them, in that we've loaded on all of the effort controls that we're so used to on top, because I almost get the thing, we can't think about fishing without them. And we can't do that with sectors. There have to be some, you have to give the flexibility for people to come up with ideas of how they're going to solve these problems and let them try. We can give a lot of guidance to them to help do that, but what we can't do is this having a fear of something happening and then putting in prohibitions that prevent them from even thinking about how to deal with it. So I think that's the frustration that's come out today. I'm not frustrated because it just suddenly dawned on me that we don't know what accountability measures should be, or that we're going to have a hard time figuring them out, or that everybody just is only thinking about hard tax. That's not what's dawned on me today, is we are not going to let sectors have a chance. And we've continually put on every at every turn, we try to, well, make sure that nothing bad can happen. We've prevented anything from happening. And once we do that, there's nothing left. So that makes me look at these alternative measures as these are really important now. If you don't have, I mean, they've always been important, but everything else is gone. So I think that's the frustration I have, and I don't know how we're going to get out of that unless we really go back and look at sectors and give them a chance. Thank you.
Dave Preble.
Yeah, thank you. I think we're really getting wrapped around the axle here. I think that what we need to do here, I would offer a motion to table the main motion until the April meeting, and to task the committee, the groundfish committee, with developing one or more accountability measure alternatives as specified in 3.4.1.2. Because I think right now we're at the point where we're spinning around in circles, and nobody wants to leave this with hard taxes the only option. That's where we sit right now, and nobody has confidence that sectors are going to be ready to go. And it strikes me that we are in danger of just going around and around in circles here without going anywhere, and we need another option is what it boils down to, and I think that's where we need to go.
Is there a second?